Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and wow, what a great way to begin the show. Jalene Jordan, congratulations. Actually, we didn't begin the show with that. We ended Motor City Riffs.
That's right. That is my very first song played on Motor City Riffs. Thank you, Doug Podell. That was with Vinny Dombrowski of Sponge Crud and the Orbitsons. I was honored enough to have him sing on that song with me, an anti-war tune that he believes in as well, and all I had to do was buy him martinis and sushi. And he works for food.
Well, why not?
Well, hey, he's my friend.
And so that's Baghdad and Beyond from Jalene's album.
Yeah, it's called What She Said, You can check out my MySpace, Jalene Jordan Music. And you can just go to WRIF.com, or you can go to PeterWerby.com.
Somebody wrote me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and we get these from time to time. Peter, we know how to spell your name, because I always say Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and if I don't say it, people, they don't get it. It's any number of spellings, Worthy.
We get Worthy a lot, or Werby, you know, W-U-R.
You know what I should do? I think you got to pay for all those.
To get all the possibilities, and then it'll go right to PeterWerby.com. I hear you.
I should have had something other than my name, like, what? You know, PeterWRIF.com.
It is what it is.
Are we on the air?
We're here. Radio for Two? Welcome, everyone.
Yeah, right. Hey, joining us at 11:30 will be my old friend, the legendary John Sinclair. And I can call him that because that's what his website says.
Well, then it is.
I think it's johnsinclair.net, if I remember.
But and he writes excellent blogs on there, by the way, from all over the world.
So people, you know, now John Sinclair is a poet, performing artist, band leader, music journalist, radio broadcaster, record producer, educator, and archivist. He was the manager of the historic MC5.
I think he's just an all-around cool dude.
He was the chair of the White Panther Party, which supported the Black Panther Party. Sometimes people, that's what I mean, some of this stuff has gone by so far away, people go, oh, yeah, that was a group for white people. But it was. But it was a for white revolutionaries back in the day, way back then. He has just done so many things. And he's here in town because there's a brand new movie out, a documentary about John, 20 to Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair. And if you go to my website.
PeterWerby.com.
No, I don't know if.
WERB.
Oh, no, you go to the calendar page, and it's opening all over Michigan, including this Friday at MOCAD. Oh, man, now I'm really stuck. I can't remember what it stands for. But it's like the Motor City Contemporary Arts Museum, but that doesn't spell MOCAD.
Let's have John clarify all of the above for us.
So he'll be on about 11:30. In the meantime, if you would like to call us, I guess I got to get my little machine going here, don't I? 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. For those of you like me who don't like those numbers.
That's right.
I need the numbers.
You don't like the letters.
The letters, thank you.
Right, yeah.
We need each other, Peter.
We do. here, the Detroit Free Press. And you can always tell whether someone is from Detroit or not because that they will, what the hell, what's going on here? No? Well, I don't know. I seem to have lost it totally. In any event, I have it here. If you say Detroit Free Press, which would be the normal way of saying things, we know you're not from Detroit because actually it's Detroit Free Press.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
We call it the Free Press.
Right, not but the Free Press.
The Free Press, yeah. Like they're in Marshall, Michigan, I don't know if they still call it, but they used to have a building called the Municipal Building.
No.
Yeah. I don't know. Are you listening in Marshall? Are you listening in Marshall, Michigan? Tell me if that's just a slur. In any event, this is like good news. The House has passed the 4.35 income tax, thus averting a shutdown tomorrow of the state government. That's it, folks. If you're listening in other areas of the country or the world, the Michigan is broke. It's about $1.5 billion in the hole. The Michigan Constitution dictates that there must be a balanced budget. So so both sides, Democrats and Republicans, are fighting about it. The Republicans naturally want to cut all these programs for everybody except for their rich buddies. And not more appealing, the Democrats want to raise the state income tax, which apparently they did. And also, they would, what was the other thing? Sales tax on all sorts of other things like astrology services, baby bronzing, baby shoe bronzing, tanning, all this stuff that before.
So they're really stretching at this point.
Right.
Now, how many days of the money that our federal government, we, the taxpayers, how many days would it take in Iraq to pay off this debt?
This is interesting.
Do some math for me.
It's pretty easy. The income tax hike, which would begin today, would raise an additional $750 million a year. And the United States is spending a day in Iraq.
$750 million.
That's very. This is actually just coincidental. I didn't even think about this as a particular point. Let me see.
Yeah, I was trying to put together the numbers on what it would take.
Yeah.
What we're wasting over there, what we could be spending to save this state and save so many, topics, other things, other people.
Yeah, and one thing.
Schools, the healthcare system.
Please do not call up and say this is all Jennifer Granholm's fault. Unless you can say Jennifer Granholm caused this by these policies. There's a lot of factors here, including what she was left with the last Republican governor,
right,
who she's a Democrat, with cutting lots of taxes on businesses.
Yeah, I hear that one a lot, and I always say, come up with something. Give me more information. What specifically are you talking about?
Right. And they don't. I mean, if you're at the top and things are going bad, it's easy to get the blame. So
absolutely.
And I understand people. But it's about what's happening in this country in general. If you think about all the economic things that are happening. HCR, or HRC, rather. I heard this for the first time tonight. HRC?
Human Rights Campaign?
No. Oh, yeah, that's what I thought I heard that before. Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Oh, is this the new one?
Yeah,
oh,
HRC and Obama both back a bigger army to blunt the soft-on-security slam. So they've been called. So, you know, the Democrats, they're such a waste, I'll tell you.
They really are.
But get this. This is the story. This year's presidential candidates are aggressively working to avoid soft-on-security images. Images! They're going to be spending tens of billions of dollars of our money on images when our damn state is in the hole and having to raise the income tax in the worst possible way. If it was a steeply graduated income tax, that is, nobody paid income tax that was making, say, under, or didn't get the raise at least, that was making under $50,000 or $75,000, okay. But what you could start doing, since there's so many millionaires in Michigan, you step it up gradually, say starting at like 8% if they're making $200,000, 10% if they're making $1 million, 20% if they're making $5 million, you know, start making these people pay the freight rather than the average person, and particularly the poor people. Because the poor people, they get hit with the sales tax. They get hit if they're the working poor or the near poor. They're the ones that get hit because someone was saying, oh, all it's going to be is $250 more a person. Well, if you're making $75,000 a year, you might have $250 in your pocket.
Sure.
If you're making $23,000 a year, which doesn't qualify you as poor by the United States government and the Census Department, $250 could mean what? Figure that out for clothing, for health care, for your kids and stuff like that. So this is really terrible.
Car payment.
And I got to tell you, these anti-tax right-wing Republican group, or conservative groups, not Republican, but conservative groups, say they're beginning recall petitions against every state legislator, Republicans and Democrats, who voted for the tax increase. And you know what I say? Adios, MF.
Sayonara.
Yeah. I don't know if the initials meant anything to everybody, but it's sort of a Detroit phrase.
Sure.
You under, yeah. Yeah,
of course I do. I work at the Riff.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, I love rock and roll.
So, so look at, I don't know. I think now I got about $9 in my pocket, and I usually don't have $250.
Gosh, I have more than you for once.
Yeah, I usually don't have $250, but it's not going to hurt me that much. But but when I see the level of poverty in this area, and the growing number of houses that are going into foreclosure and all that, and these people are making the poor and the near poor and even the middle class disproportionately pay for all the mistakes that have been made, either in general or specifically, it just really gets my, what's the word?
Your goat. Now, let me give you an example.
My goat. Yeah.
2 days ago, Peter, whatever that means, we need to find the origin. You know how we always need the origin of these things. Get my goat, what does it mean? Email us. I was at Walgreens, and this poor little old lady was trying to get a prescription, and she was $10 short. And they, of course, were not going to give it to her. So I heard this going on. I was standing in line behind her, and I gave her $10. And
oh, that's so nice.
I gave her $10. This was life or death medicine that she needed, something that she depends upon for her health care to survive. And so who's going to give her the $10 next time, Peter? No,
everybody will just look away.
Absolutely. Yeah. No one cared. Yeah. No one cared.
I was in a gas station last winter, and some guy came up to me and said, can I pump your gas for a quarter? And, I mean, the whole thing of it just, I said, no, thank you, I'm sorry. And the guy, and it was like about 15 degrees out. And the guy went over and sat on a stack of tires. This was after I'd eaten with my friends after playing handball and all that. And I'd probably dropped $25 on dinner or something like that. And I looked at the guy, and I went over to him, and I gave him $5. And he said, oh, thank you. And then he looked, and he saw it was a $5. He said, oh, thank you, sir. Thank you. You know, God bless you. I promise you I'll only spend it on food. And it was like something out of a Dickens novel of, 19th century England or something like that. And and charity, I mean, this is good of us. It really is good.
It is.
On the other hand, all charity is vertical. That is to say, it flows downward. forward, and it's maintained like that. One of the things that with all the charities is it maintains this equation of wealth and poverty in place. What's got to be altered is to alter it horizontally, so we don't have these multi-billionaires. And even our liberal friends, Oprah, last year made $260 million. What the hell is she doing with that?
How? Well, she's building schools in Africa. She's doing some good, right?
She is. They all are.
I mean, she has 80 homes, but I have to say on the homeless note, down at Eastern Market, I was down there, this summer one time, and this homeless woman came up, and I gave her $5, and I said, please, go eat something. And I'm telling you, Peter, 20 minutes later, I saw her eating one of those giant burgers you get from Burt's Warehouse, when they come out there and barbecue. Yeah. And I was so happy. In fact, after the erotica ball, I saw her in the parking lot again, and she wanted money. And I said, you know what? I saw you eating last time, so here you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oprah Winfield.
Winfrey.
Sorry, what the hell do I know? I am. What's that guy's name? I don't even know.
You're devoid of pop culture.
What's it? What's the guy you always tell me I'm like?
Regis. It's the Regis and Kelly, Peter and Julene. I'm the pop culture girl.
I have no idea.
That's what I'm here for.
I've seen him. Oopra Winfrey, $260 billion, second on the on the list of who's earning what on TV. Jerry Seinfeld, she made $260 million. Seinfeld, $60 million, almost all off
rerun. Syndication.
Letterman, $40 million. Simon Cowell made $45 million.
American Idol, baby.
Just being a judge, he gets $45
million. Oh, well, yeah, he has a stake in the show.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
We know three of them are liberals, at least. Donald Trump made $32 million. What the hell is he? You know, what is with Donald Trump? He's got ads running on radio and television for these, schlock get rich using my method. You ever heard those?
No.
I mean, it's amazing.
But really, Peter, is it surprising?
No.
No.
Jay Leno, $32 million. Dr. Phil, $30 million. Judge Judy Scheindlin. I've never seen Dr. Phil. I've never seen Judge Judy.
Okay, well. Well, Dr. Phil, whatever.
Who's George Lopez?
He's a comedian, and he has a show called The George Lopez Show.
Wow, $26 million. Kiefer Sutherland. I've heard that name, but I have no idea.
You know Donald Sutherland?
Yeah.
It's his son.
Yeah, what does he do?
He's the star of a television show called 24.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Regis Philbin, I know who he is.
You are him.
Tyra Banks, $18 million.
You know who she is?
No.
She's this beautiful model.
Mm-hmm.
Has a talk show, does a show called, is it Project Runway or what? No, America's Top Model. I don't watch a lot of these shows. I just know.
Rachel Ray?
She is.
$16 million.
Yeah, she's a talk show host, but started out on Food Network.
Katie Couric, she's the host of NBC.
Is it NBC?
CBS.
Yeah.
What a lightweight. She said the only way she could remember the president of Iran's name, Ahmadinejad, almost.
And you didn't even have to look.
Yeah, Ahmadinejad. She said, what is it? Oh, I can't remember. Something really stupid. I'm a dinner jacket.
Oh, my.
I mean, what a lightweight.
That's not good.
Yeah. I know who Ellen DeGeneres is, $15 million, and Ryan Seacrest. It sounds like a racehorse.
Do you know who that is?
No idea.
That's the guy who hosts American Idol. He also has his own radio show in Los Angeles, and he's also on the E! Entertainment Network, and on and on and on. That number is going to be much higher next year.
Matt Lauer,
Today's Show.
Okay. Barbara Walters, I know who she is.
Good.
Diane Sawyer, I know who she is.
Great.
And Meredith Vieira comes in 20th place in top earners. Oprah making $260 million. Meredith Vieira is...
What, five? She was on The View, and now she is on the Today Show with
Meredith.
Matt Lauer. Yeah.
Meredith. Oh,
yeah.
She's sweet.
Yeah, I like her, too. Yeah. She's got spunk, and she's smart.
I wonder if any of them are, this is in the Eat the Rich department. They have now a Lamborghini, a car, $1.4 million.
Whoa. Whoa.
In the meantime.
I wonder who the first person to buy one of those would be.
Oh, they're sold out. They completely sold them out. 20 cars and gone.
Jeez.
In the meantime, the war in Iraq costs us $12 billion a month. What's wrong here?
$750 million a day is really the number, I think, that works best when I talk to people. Yeah.
Well, this awful dictator came to the United States last week, president of a country that allows no freedoms, and you know that is, of course, right?
That's Ahmadinejad.
No.
Oh.
Gurbanguly Birdi Mukhammadayev.
Hey, listen.
I blew it. I had it all practiced.
Give it to me. I can say it.
I know. His name is... Okay, go ahead.
Okay, wait. I have to find it.
His first name is Gurbanguly. His last name is Birdi Mukhammadayev.
Okay, yeah.
Birdi Mukhammadayev. Yeah. He is the president of Turkmenistan. And he, of course, had thousands in the streets denouncing him. And no, he didn't, right? In fact, no one even knew he was here. I didn't know he was here till I randomly, I don't even know why, I was looking through the business section of the New York Times the other day on the 26th, I guess it was, this is when this is from, and read that American officials striving to weaken the grip of Russia's state-owned energy monopoly in Central Asia are courting the president of Turkmenistan on his first visit to the United States. The visit by Gurbanguly. Well, I had a little trouble with Ahmadinejad. I never was good with names. Gurbanguly Brimukhamadov, the first by a Turkmen president since 1998, included a meeting Tuesday with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice of the United Nations on Wednesday will revolve around the opening of the General Assembly. American officials said they wanted Mr. Birdi Mukhammadov. There you go.
You're
to understand
including.
That he had other options for developing the country's extensive natural gas deposits and for shipping the fuel to market. So,
okay, what are you saying? Can you cliff note that for me?
Yeah, yeah. Here's this dictator that comes from Turkmenistan, that whose country is more repressive than Iran. And Iran's pretty repressive, but you can kind of get around the corner. I mean, it's not as bad as this. And this place is nuts. Let's see.
I mean, how much nuttier can it get?
Well, here.
As far as women go,
I'm
perhaps?
It's a Muslim country, so it's pretty bad, too. Oh, yeah, here. The Turkmen government tolerates no dissent, allows no media or political freedoms, has driven into exile or imprisoned members of the political opposition, human rights defenders, and independent journalists. Dissidents are treated as criminals, have been subjected to internal exile, forced eviction from their homes, confiscation of their personal property. Several have been forcibly detained in psychiatric hospitals. Torture is rampant in places of detention. A human rights defender died in prison in highly suspicious circumstances recently. Dozens of people arrested in the wake of an armed attack on the former president, Niyazov, in 2002 are believed to be held incommunicado following closed trials. The government banned opera, ballet, the circus, the Philharmonic Orchestra, and non-Turkmen cultural associations. Religious believers, particularly followers of faiths other than Sunni Islam and Russian Orthodoxy, have faced criminal prosecutions, police beatings, deportation, in some cases, demolition of their houses of worship. This is in Turkmenistan, folks. This is the man, the president of it, is being welcomed by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, whereas Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been elevated by what? By the press, by the media.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
And the Bush administration.
The Bush administration as the most evil person in the world. Well, what Iran is this right-wing religious theocracy.
I have a new game we could play.
What's that?
Who is more evil?
There you go. Well, Bush spoke at the UN on Tuesday, and he's talking about a mission of liberation. And in Belarus, Syria, Iran, and North Korea as brutal regimes that deny people their rights. And he also mentioned, this was before this all went down, Myanmar, Zimbabwe, and Cuba as a, what did he say? Well, I wouldn't say it's a brutal regime in Cuba. I mean, it's a police.
It's a regime.
It's a regime, yeah. It's a long-standing one. But he didn't mention Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan.
Why is that? Because they don't have something we need?
Because it is Pipelinistan.
It's already in.
Yeah, well, okay. They're working for it. And so it doesn't matter. So, I mean, people, you know, we are playing. You know, how dumb are you? And I always say us. I mean, we're trying to be like knights. We're saying, how dumb are we? But it's how dumb are you? Are you going to swallow this again like you did around Iraq and look at the results of this? How easily George W. Bush and this criminal cabal in Washington manipulated all of us into supporting a war till it has just gone south so badly.
And like you said, just said, it's only we go against the countries where we can't get the oil, the countries where there's possible oil. Oh, come on, let's shake your hand, let's have a White House dinner.
And they're friendly with us. So yes. Now the big evil enemies are Ahmadinejad, Chavez in Venezuela, and Morales in Bolivia, where I guess Ahmadinejad made a little stop after he left here and was so rudely introduced. Man, it was, he spoke at Columbia University, and the president of Columbia University extended this invitation to Ahmadinejad to speak there and then denounced him as an introduction, which is
very strange.
Bad taste. You know, Khrushchev came here during the Cold War. They had said they were going to bury us, and he was received with courtesy as a head of state. Reagan knew that in dealing with Gorbachev that there was much to be gained by discussions and diplomacy, but that's not what Bushko, this racket posing as a government, wants. It wants the maintenance of enemies to justify the military-industrial complex. All right, so Bush, in his statement talking about liberation, didn't mention all of these countries that are just the worst, most repressive regimes, worse than the ones he named. Well, not worse than North Korea. But one big one that's real close to Iran and Iraq that he didn't mention was Saudi Arabia, cut off people's hands and women can't drive and any kind of opposition and people are immediately killed. People are whipped and all of that. Well, he just didn't mention anything about that. He's talking about free election. Bush, listen, the best you can say is he became president and then reelected through contested elections. I mean, I say he stole them both, but at least they're both contested. And in terms of freedom within countries, well, you know, we have politics that are totally dominated by elites and their wealth. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk to John Sinclair about this brand-new documentary, 20 to Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. And, hey, if you're on hold, we're going to get to you. Stay there or call in. I haven't looked, but there may be open lines.
This is WRIF.com.
Oh, can't take no more.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much and welcome back. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. And why did I think we'd easily have John Sinclair?
He'll be calling in. We've got it going on.
He just flew in.
Yeah, he just got here.
Flew in from London. And not Ontario.
Right.
Yeah, he's coming here now.
Across the big pond.
I don't want to give away what's going to... But he's here for the premiere of a movie, a documentary about John Sinclair called 20 to Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair. And, man, the soundtrack is just absolutely amazing, but I don't want to give it away.
John, let's let him talk about it.
He may be sleeping. But there's John Lennon, Yoko Ono are in it, Allen Ginsberg, the MC5, a lot of other people.
And I know someone else who's in it.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Werby.
Yeah, I do a little cameo there. I was actually startled. Adam Brooke, who handles a lot of stuff for John.
Tour manager here in the States.
Yeah, and he was saying that there's footage of me fronting off the cops.
Fronting off?
You don't know that phrase?
I thought you were... It was a turn of phrases, so
is
to speak.
That a faded phrase?
Perhaps
like,
it is. I
like
thought you were...
Far out?
I still say that.
Far out is coming back.
Yeah. And you know what? You always tell me I'm way too humble. You're way too humble.
Well,
that is so cool you're in there, Peter.
I have something... I make an appearance also in a film that John is in. The John Lennon film, The U.S. versus John Lennon.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And
I never saw you in there, but I think it was because you were in a big, huge audience, aunt.
Here's what happened.
Okay.
My wife and I are sitting watching this film, and there was a section of the film where it talks about how this group, they never did find out, this group broke in to an FBI headquarters in a city called Media, Pennsylvania. And they liberated all these FBI files of they were, you know, illegally and secretly tracking people. And they just really quickly they showed all these files and all that. So they showed them all. And then they went on to the next scene. And I looked at my wife and I said, and she's looked at me and she said, was your name on one of those files? And I said, yeah, I think so.
For real?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you had a file.
Yeah.
Did they forget about you? Did they figure out
you're
pretty harmless?
I have subpoena envy.
Me too.
Here, look what I have for you.
Oh, what do you have?
Look at a little
present?
A little, no.
Oh, apply today for the convenient Citgo Plus credit card.
A Citgo credit card. So you can buy Citgo gas with a credit card.
Really? Well, why can't I just... I just use my debit card.
You can do that, yeah.
But if I were to get one, I would get one from Citgo.
Because think about this. Here's another guy that's been elevated to the level of enemy of the United States.
Oh, Mr. Chavez?
Yes, of Venezuela. The president, the man who was elected president with huge margins where there is no allegations whatsoever that there was anything wrong.
Right. You know, elected by the people.
Yeah. I heard there's an FM talk station, which is just blah, 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 blah. Like that. A couple guys in the afternoon are kind of funny. I don't even want to give them any credits.
No, they're not.
No?
No.
Okay. All right. But I heard one of them say, Chavez, the dictator of Venezuela. And this is the
How
kind
about
of
Bush, the dictator of the United States there, brother.
That's the kind of nonsense. That's the kind of nonsense that passes through people's brains because they suck it out of the, particularly the right-wing media, but sometimes the corporate media.
Fox News.
Yeah.
Two words.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it comes on the regular news. I was looking at the Associated Press, and it was talking about the Ahmadinejad a visit to Bolivia with, what's Morales? I can't think of Morales' first name. President Morales, another man elected by a great majority.
People.
Evo. I think his name is Evo. Yeah, Evo Morales. Yeah. And extraordinarily popular, but he is now an enemy of the United States because he doesn't want to turn over the wealth of the country to have it looted by these, the colossus of the North, which essentially, not us, but the American corporations. Mm-hmm. We don't get much of it. So anyways, Associated Press was talking about him, and they said, Morales, a strident leftist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that just goes...
So thanks for your opinion.
Yeah. So do they ever mention, they say, George Bush, a strident rightist?
Right.
Have you ever seen that?
What happened to being unbiased?
Well,
and writing in an unbiased manner as a journalist. That's what I was taught when I went to college.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't think there ever was this golden age of journalism in the mainstream media. Reformers, everybody from anti-slavers to the women's suffrage movement.
Suffragette movement.
Yeah, to the labor movement in the 1890s, the first part of the 20th
civil
century,
rights.
1930, the civil rights, the anti-war movements, all had to create its own media. The corporate press always lies, always takes the side of the corporations.
Now, but the Washington Post is a little better, isn't it?
Well,
come on.
It's a little better than Fox News.
How about the Fifth Estate?
The Fifth Estate. That's there.
Our guest is here, Peter.
Oh, but okay, let me just finish one thing.
Okay.
Here, this is a big ad in the New York Times. Venezuela and the Bronx building a bridge of solidarity for the people. And CITGO is going to give approximately $4 million in grants to multiple Bronx organizations, including the North Star Fund, the Point Community Development Corporation, and a number of others. These grants will help in the development of environmental restoration projects and social programs inspired by the actions of people helping people.
How awful of them. So, hey, you right-wing people from hell, make sure you don't buy your gas from someone who does something good for people.
No. What you want to do, of course, is go to, like, Gulf or Exxon Mobile, so all of your money can go to pay for the $44 million retirement fund of their CEO, of the company that's been gouging us regularly.
Yeah, have fun filling his pockets. Don't think about yourself ever.
Speaking of having fun, let's welcome my old friend, John Sinclair. John Sinclair, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. Oh, no, that's what you're usually at. Welcome to Night Call.
Night Call.
Yes,
hey,
with Julie Jordan as well. How you doing, brother?
I'm okay. I'm a little beat up, but I'm all right.
We explained that you came over from London, so you've got a little bit of jet lag, huh?
My wings are sore.
Well, tell us about this incredible, man, I can't imagine this. 20 to Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair.
Yeah, huh? What about that, huh?
Yeah.
I'd like to start by asking about the title.
What's 20 to Life refer to?
Well, 20 to Life was what the penalty for giving away two joints of marijuana was.
I told you that, Peter. I told you that.
Wait a minute. You got 9.5 to 10. 10 for 2. 10 for 2 joints.
I faced the 20 to life, mandatory 20, for 2.5 years. They dropped it to possession on the day before my trial because they we didn't blink. You know, but that was set for dispensing. I was charged with dispensing.
Because you allegedly, or maybe you'll even cop to it now, gave...
No, I did it.
He copped to it, right on.
Well, let me just reintroduce you. John Sinclair, as it says here, I think accurately, is a real American character. Poet, performing artist, and band leader, music journalist, radio broadcaster, record producer, educator, archivist, and John from the small town of Davison, Michigan. Became a cultural activist, founder of the Detroit Artist Workshop, manager of the MC5, and chairman of the White Panther Party. And that was just for starters. That was just the first 2 years.
That was 40 years ago,
You're still going strong, though.
Pretty much.
I mean, you are just going.
With both feet, yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about these openings. This is absolutely incredible. This is the world premiere is going to be happening all around the state of Michigan.
Yeah, well, actually, the world premiere, we just did it in Italy for a month. We went all around Italy.
Okay, the Michigan premiere.
US. Okay. US.
Yeah.
We were in London last night at the Rain Dance Film Festival and had a really great time there.
How has the response been so far?
I'm traveling with the director, Steve Gebhardt, and we're introducing and doing Q&As afterwards.
John, how has the response been so far? Stay in Italy.
Oh, it's been terrific. We made the Italian subtitles for the screenings there, and so it helped the audience so quite a bit. You know, they understood what we were saying. So.
Now,
but yeah, it's pretty. Maybe a certain kind of person like ourselves, it's hard to dislike.
Now,
here, here.
The U.S. premiere.
We aren't very well represented in the world of film, so this one we are.
Now, the U.S. premiere is going to be Tuesday night, October 2nd, at the Flint Institute of Arts. Is that
in my hometown on my birthday?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's incredible. Happy birthday! I looked at it and I said, "Oh no, Tuesday! I'm gonna have to choose between this and playing handball." But no, but
you'll have to because there's a Detroit.
Well, you're in the movie, man, so you'll get specially honored if you're there.
Well, I think I'm gonna wait and go to the.
I was just watching you on this big screen last night.
How was
in London? You know, you're in there for twice. You didn't make the movie, The Shoot on the Roof. I remember that. We tried to get you, but it was too early in the morning.
It was.
We had all been up all night on acid, and we tried to get you out of bed. I remember that vividly. There's a picture. I'm holding up a picture of you and Dina Clemage and another person standing in the window of the...
Fifth Estate. Detroit committed in the war in Vietnam.
Oh, that's with the broken out window.
Yeah.
I'll put that on my website.
I hold that up and say this is, you know, what they did here, the right wingers. But the one that I didn't realize it was you was at the media conference, underground media conference in Ann Arbor when the police raided, the county sheriffs raided the
home. Right.
And there's a shot of a guy standing there in a defiant attitude with a couple of pigs pointing the rifles at him. And last night I realized it was you. I said, there's Morby.
Yeah, now
I have to see this one.
Me.
Is this, hey, John, is this a film or a still?
I guess, I don't know. It was films because Lenny was shooting.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, no, I remember that. We were having this conference about media and repression, and suddenly the Ann Arbor police raid. And imagine the Ann Arbor police.
No, this was the county sheriff.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
And Harvey.
And I wish they would have had, rifles. They had sawed-off shotguns.
Wow.
Yeah. So I insisted that I went up to him and said, hey, we're not going to hurt you. Yeah. But this is going to be wait a minute. There are a few people that I think have more general interest in the film, 20 to Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair, than me. Give us kind of a rundown who else is going to appear in this
documentary.
Thank you, Julie.
Well, you know, from my point of view, the thing I like about it is it has quite a few of my performances with different musical ensembles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's in it for me. But there's all kinds of people, the MC5, the whole MC5 segment. There's a segment with the Detroit riots of 67 set to The Motor City's Burning, like a video. Thrilling. Jeannie Parker, formerly Jeannie Pomandon. Pum Pomandon plays a pretty big role as a talking head and interpreter of, you know, what happened. Frank Bach.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono, too.
Yeah, they're
people
there,
may
yeah,
know
yeah.
them.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, people may know them.
Allen Ginsberg. The local color. Ginsberg, my idol.
All right, so.
Ed Sanders.
Let's see. I'm definitely going to meet you. Not in Flint, but.
Okay, Saturday we're in Detroit at MoCAD.
Which is the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. It's south
Woodward and Garfield.
which is just south of Wayne State University. It's going to begin at 7 o'clock. Steve Gebhardt, the filmmaker, will be introducing it, an hour-and-a-half screening, then a Q&A with John Sinclair and the filmmaker, and after-party, the Butcher's Inn in Eastern Market.
Eastern Market, Don Bailey.
I'm ready. I'm ready for it.
I'm
ready for it all.
It'll be good. And Wednesday the 10th in Ann Arbor, Michigan Theater. There's scenes that were shot at the Michigan Theater, so that'll be a kick, you know.
And you can go to my website calendar, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and get all of these performances around the state. There's also Grand Rapids and Traverse City and a couple other places. And the film is 20 to Life. I'm sorry. The website is 20tolifefilm.com. Yeah.
And that's 20 spelled out.
Right. The word 20. 20tolifefilm.com. Well, this all must be pretty thrilling for you.
Oh, man, I'm thrilled beyond belief. I love the movie, so that's the first part. And I've seen it over and over again.
And
I still like it. So they say, well, that's because it's about you. And I say, no, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't be able to watch it twice.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, and you're going to do a performance as well.
Afterwards, yeah.
Yeah. Wait a minute. It says, there's the performance.
Your poetry? Are you doing your poetry?
Yeah.
Set the music.
Because that's what you do now, right? This is your new occupation.
Yeah.
Well,
I've been doing this since about 1964.
Right. But this is what you're focusing on currently.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Well, John Sinclair.
I call it pursuing my performing arts career in earnest.
That's beautiful.
And you've got another documentary coming out, don't you? Isn't there?
I don't know.
We'll talk to your manager.
I'll think of, maybe this is the one I'm thinking about. I thought there was something else in the pipeline. But
he already has two.
16 years in the making, man. You know, so this has been in the pipeline for a long time.
It has.
That has to be very satisfying.
Finally out, we got all the music and all the footage that we used from the Chicago convention riots and Detroit and all that. We got everything licensed, so
that's terrific.
Street legal, as the bar.
Well, listen.
How fitting.
As always. And I definitely, I'll try to give you a call tomorrow. We'll set something up and make sure that we hang together for at least a minute as usual.
Oh, that'll be good.
All right, John.
Yeah, thanks, Pete.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Good to talk to you.
Hope to see you Saturday.
Don't hope. I'll be there for sure.
Okay. All right. With bells on.
Or something. I just hope that there is not any cops there with sawed-off shotguns. Why was I so crazy?
Well, now it's pepper spray and rubber bullets.
Well, that's good. Well, yeah.
Mostly pepper spray.
I didn't shoot any of this. I actually have John's book, The Guitar Army, both the old, you know, first edition of it,
right,
and also the brand
newly
new.
Released.
The newly released.
Or re-released, we should say.
And I was looking through it for that photograph of me.
Did you find it?
No.
Oh.
I don't know where it is. I saw it somewhere. All right. I love the show. It's all about me.
Peter.
But actually, it's about Ahmadinejad.
It's about the people.
It is about Berdi Muhammadov, whose first name is Gurbanguly Berdi Muhammadov.
Oh, you're getting very good at that.
Who's the Turkmen president who was welcome, even though he runs this vicious police state. Let me see. What else? Oh, yeah. Another thing, too, about this, that when Ahmadinejad when he appeared at Columbia University and at the UN, thousands of people came out to protest him because what were the two things? He denied the Holocaust, and he said we're going to wipe Israel off the map, which is kind of standard fare for all these guys in the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know, even the people that the United States, us, is giving money to.
Right.
And then there was when Bush spoke there with his lying speech a day later or so, there was 400 people came out to protest against Bush. I mean, 400. Mm. So it could have been. I think I remember something. There was like 25,000 people came out to protest Ahmadinejad. 400 comes out to
How dumb are you?
Yeah, there's
How dumb are we?
Whoop, we got to get these in. We'll be right back, and we haven't taken a single call. We are going to,
as soon as we come back,
it's all about you. It's no longer about me, no longer about Jalene Jordan.
Right.
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. This normally is a talk show, except just Jalene and I have been talking to each other, playing some of Jalene's music at the beginning of the show. By the way, that will be on the podcast.
And what's wrong with that? What?
Nothing,
okay.
Nothing. That'll be on the podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
I mean, wonderful.
Yeah, what the hell? What
and we spoke with John Sinclair.
Yes, the legendary manager of the MC5, the founder of the White Panther Party, the poet, the whatever. Anyways, there's going to be a film showing, a Michigan premiere on Tuesday up in Flint, Michigan, of his brand new documentary called 20 to Life, The Life and Times of John Sinclair. And on Saturday, it will be at MOCAD. Which is, I can't remember what the hell it is, but there it is. But I might be able
something
to
in Garfield, I think.
Yeah.
I remember
yeah. It's if you go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, and I'm going to be there because apparently I'm in the film as well.
Not apparently, you are, and
I
you
am
are twice.
Film. I am twice, yeah.
Can't wait.
And we're also talking about Bush scolding brutal regimes as he pushes democracy, except he doesn't push democracy in Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Saudi Arabia.
O-I-L.
Yeah. Egypt. How about Egypt? Egypt, you know, one of the things that the reason that Ahmadinejad and Iran have arisen as the great enemy is because they deny the Holocaust. Well, you know, in Egypt, they teach that all this anti-Semitic crap about the elders, the protocols, the elders of Zion, and all this absolutely insane Nazi stuff. And we're paying Egypt billions and billions and billions of dollars in aid, right?
And I say, did you know that?
Yeah. So, and it is. What's it all
There's
about?
There's another game we can play.
O-I-L.
Yeah. Did you know that?
Yeah. Now, that's a song by our pal David Rovics, Operation Iraqi Liberation. What does that spell? O-I-L. But also in 1990, that Bob Dole, when they were doing the run-up to the first Gulf War, they said, what's it about? He said, it's about three letters, O-I-L. And all of a sudden, this big hook came and yanked him off stage.
Right away.
Oh, no, it's about freedom. It's about... Yeah.
Sure.
So I had some... Oh, yeah. I wanted to mention this.
How dumb
well.
Are you?
Right. Where is... Oh, this has gone so far. Oh, no, here it is. This is very cool as well, although this... one of the nights conflicts with the movie with John. I'm going to try to make everything. It's the 9th Annual Motor City Blues and Boogie Woogie Festival. Now, if you have not been to one of those, get ready to Boogie Woogie because they have Boogie Woogie dancers.
Is that song going to put on my Boogie Woogie shoes? I'm not singing it.
Yeah, okay.
During the commercial.
Friday night, and this is down at the Music Hall. It used to be out at the Royal Oak Music Theater, but it's going to be at the Music Hall downtown. Friday night, Coco Taylor and her blues machine. Man, she is fabulous. And then...
Girl can sing.
It is not on my calendar. Does that take care of business? It seems like there's something else.
I, you know what it is?
No. What?
It's called, let's take some phone calls.
One second.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm trying to direct the traffic of the show.
We were talking earlier.
This Jalene, is my job.
Jalene and I were talking about how we were giving money to the poor, and I said that that charity is always vertical downward.
Which really, I think, could you give it another explanation of what you mean by that?
Well, it's the well-off given to the poor, but the equation of poor, rich and poor, well-off and poor remain.
Okay.
But Stephen writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, have you forgotten about the corporate bailouts? Is that not charity? Right. So we're, you know, it's all going upwards. So we pay for that. Absolutely correct, Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen... Another Steve. Dearborn Heights says, or Steve, this is, you've said many times in your show that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will wind up costing the U.S. taxpayer just over $2 trillion when you factor in all the costs of taking care of vets for decades to come. Well, I think that number is way, way too low. Bush next week will seek $190 billion more for wars in 2008. If approved, Congress would have appropriated more than $760 billion for the two wars. Having already approved $450 billion for Iraq, $127 for Afghanistan.
So I'd say we agree.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm
you're
see
right.
Where the
we're,
rest of,
we're low.
Yeah, that's, anyways, he goes on with a lot of other stuff. It's twice your estimate. Never underestimate Bush and his wanting to line his friends' pockets.
Hey.
I agree.
Hey, Steve, we won't.
Yeah.
We will not underestimate.
We
promise.
Yeah.
And thank you for not underestimating.
Kathy. Kathy's listening in Green Bay, Wisconsin. She says, if you get a chance, we were talking about Evo Morales, El Presidente de Bolivia. No, yeah, Bolivia. See, mm-hmm. If you get a chance, see if you can find the video of Morales' appearance on The Daily Show last week. An excellent interview.
Okay. That's cool. We'll look for it.
Oh, yeah, he was in. You know, he's got like a line of sweaters.
Really? No.
He does. He does. He doesn't pocket the money. But if you go, Morales, Morales, and go sweaters. You'll probably have to look on Comedy Central's website. It seems to have disappeared from YouTube. It says there's a copyright claim by Viacom.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we go to the phones?
I think we should, Peter.
313. Whew. Marion.
298-WRIF.
I'm just stunned here that Marion from Dearborn has held on for 57 minutes.
Marion?
Hi, Peter.
Angelina.
It was good listening, though, wasn't it, while you waited?
Oh, it was excellent.
Okay.
I was wondering if you're familiar with a website called freedomtofascism.com.
Well, I'm familiar with the film of that name.
By Aaron Russo?
Yeah, it's a load of crap, I think.
You think so?
Yeah. Because it's all about the Federal Reserve, and it says America was a free country till 1912 and all this, when they brought in the Federal Reserve System, which then gave all the money to the elites. And if you really start following their links, you start getting all this anti-Semitic stuff. Yeah, because it's part of this mythology that we had this wonderful free country where everybody lived prosperously and what have you. Well, that was a period of intense labor. I mean, first off, I mean, by 1912, blacks were getting more and more and more segregated. The Klan was getting more and more powerful. Women couldn't vote. The labor movement was being repressed by increasingly by increasing repression, the National Guard, Pinkerton detectives, local police forces. I mean, in many ways, the 1890s and the first part of the 20th century made the labor strife of the 1930s pale by comparison. So it's run by the money nuts that somehow they think if we were on the gold standard and all our money was backed by gold, then everything would be okay.
See, a guy at work gave me this. I had just looked at it. I didn't get all into it that deep.
But you know what, Miriam?
You had heard about it.
Well, I think, Miriam, that it's really important that you did ask that question because Peter had the answer, and so you didn't waste your friggin' time going to it.
Because there's a lot of right wing stuff out there that actually verges towards the fascist right that has this sort of rebellious quality to it, this anti-corporate nature to it. Because you got to remember, the fascists all throughout Europe in the 1930s were, at least their public stance was, that they were very anti-corporate as well. They were for the middle class, and they were for the working class. Of course, it was a lie. Once they got in power, they just empowered the corporations to the extent that it was, another name for fascism is corporatism. But careful of this stuff. It's, it sometimes has good stuff. Other times is really dangerous critiques in the sense that it really does not give you the information that we need. But thank you, Miriam. I appreciate your call. Let's see. David is a truck driver, says the state has shut down every rest stop in the state.
What?
That's the budget crisis.
I was just driving from west home today, and I didn't notice that. Just happen?
Yeah, it did.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, it says lawmakers, why is this thing updated at 10:45? Is this
now you can't even take a pee?
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about that. Well, I've seen guys taking whizzes just on the side of the road.
Hey, listen, grab a Folgers can, people of Michigan, and a roll of toilet paper.
Yeah, I'm not getting good information here. But apparently, the House has they've passed a temporary extension bill that should, in other words, that
keeps things open except for the rest areas?
Yeah, and they've kicked people out of all the state parks.
Really?
Yeah.
So, but really, let's start with one of the most basic human functions. God.
Yeah.
I'm so disgusted right now. I mean, that just sent me over the edge.
Well, maybe you won't be able to travel as much.
No, I'll take my coffee can. I camp. I'm a nature girl.
Pardon me.
And I'll be mad the whole time about it.
I'm trying to get this updated a little to... Okay. Budget deal now hangs on Senate vote. The Michigan House voted 57-52 to raise the state income tax from 3.9% to 4.35, a keystone to an overall budget agreement that would avert a state government shutdown on Monday. Now, I said earlier that there are already conservative groups that are threatening to begin recall proceedings against every legislator, Republican and Democrat, who voted for this. And they're going to have also this deal where they're going to have a sales tax on stuff that has not been taxed before. And I was mentioning them before, just from memory, but astrology, baby shoe
bronzing,
bail bonding, balloonograms are now going to be taxed.
Peter, I feel like I'm in the middle of the Twilight Zone right now. Am I dreaming? Am I sleeping? Is it a nightmare? What else?
Comfort Station Operation Services. What the hell does that mean?
Comfort Station Operation Services.
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Social Escort Services.
Have you read the back of the Metro Times lately?
I know. That's just what I was thinking. So all these gals and guys and these guys posing as gals are going to... there's a big market for...
No, I think that's wrong. They shouldn't... Leave them alone.
Yeah.
Give them some. Hey, how about some health care for those people?
Palm reading services are going to be taxed.
I know. I should live in Amsterdam.
Yes. Fortune telling services, discount buying services.
These are the most ridiculous things I have ever heard of.
Yeah. Party planning services, pay telephones. Who the hell goes to pay telephones anymore?
Well, they do. People still do. Not everyone has a cell phone or a home phone, Peter.
Shoe shines.
Oh, damn! What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Get my Converse shined.
Wedding planners, tanning, more escort services, armored cars.
Armored car? Does that include Humvees?
I guess skiing. They're going to tax skiing. If you just live, you're not in Michigan. What we're talking about here is the state government's about to shut down because there's not enough money to fund this $1.5 billion deficit. We're advocating. You know, maybe they could just, shut down everything in Iraq for 2 days and then we're paid off.
2 days. Why don't you just give us three and give us a little extra cushion?
There you go.
We'll take that.
Yeah.
Maddening.
Let's see. Scenic transportation, whatever the hell that is.
Oh, maybe that's like taking a bus tour or something?
Okay.
Or?
They didn't want to mess
with... Oh, no. Hot air balloon, right?
They did not want to mess with you too much. Here is what is not taxed.
Okay.
Cable television. Sports tickets, golf, man, again, don't mess with golf.
Oh, these are all things. Oh, okay.
Movies, legal fees, accounting, and haircuts. I wouldn't care about that. I get one every 6 months, whether I need one or not.
You look better with the shaggy look anyway, Peter.
Oh, man, I was just going to get a cut. Should I leave it like
that?
Yeah. And shaving, I don't have to shave hardly anymore because that's a look, isn't it?
You're right there.
Who's that guy?
Right there, Peter.
Who's that guy on, what's that hospital show?
Oh, you know what? I don't know. You know why?
Swayze. Patrick Swayze?
Yeah. Do you think he's on a show right now?
Oh, no, no, no. He's the guy.
You mean Clooney, who was on ER way long ago?
No, no, no. Who's the guy? It's Grey's Anatomy.
See, I don't know because, Peter, look at me. Look.
I'm looking at
look. I don't watch television.
Oh, okay. Well, I do. I look over my wife's shoulder.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's already...
And then you're in disgust, and you go, and you leave the room.
Hey, by the way, we've got some... I don't get it. That's the problem. You know, these things are like
soap
operas.
Does anyone get it?
Yeah, if you get on board on these things, they all make sense. But so it's like a soap opera, so they're ongoing. Let's see.
It's ongoing insanity.
Comfort Station Operation Services mean janitors. Oh, you know, they got fancy names. Like they have petroleum transfer agents, you know, guys that pump gas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, I can dig it.
Yeah. Lots of open lines. I know you don't believe we're going to take any more calls, but...
let's go.
Yeah, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Okay. Here's Todd in Rockwood. Todd, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for waiting.
How you doing tonight, Peter?
Good, thanks.
Good. You know, it's something how the government comes up with all these plans to shut down our government when they can't make a balanced budget. However, they're still going to tax us on our gasoline.
Our escort services?
Yeah, well,
he means that even if it's shut down, the taxation is going to continue.
Continue, I get you.
If it's shut down, then we should be able to go get our gas right now and not pay the 17 cents a gallon for taxes. We should be able to go to the store and not pay taxes at the store.
Right.
Like where you're going.
Yeah. I mean, why can they make all these decisions? But if when we try to do something on our own lives, our government's telling us what we have to pay for and what we don't have.
There's a word for that, Peter. What is it?
Taxation without representation is the phrase.
The phrase, okay.
Next, you're going to be talking about revolution.
Oh.
Now, you're getting crazy on us now.
that popped a thought right out of my head. Oh, well, Mom always said if it's important, you'll remember it. Thank you, Todd. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF.
That was a really good point.
Tom in Waterford. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Going great.
That's good. This is a first-time caller. I just want to call and say thank you to you and Jolene for being on the radio. I don't get to watch too much TV and listen to the news much, so I get to hear a lot of the information from you guys. And I just want to call and say thanks. And there's a lot of things that I agree with you. And you beat me to the punch. I didn't have too much to say about on this phone call, but you beat me to the punch about how you said, I think it was either you or Julian saying that we should shut down Iraq for a couple of days to help the state out. I was thinking, I heard one of the callers or someone that emailed you say that, you know, it's going to cost, Bush is wanting $190 billion
more
coming up.
Yeah.
In addition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why can't we just pull the heck out of Iraq and have him ask for that much money and give it to the states, help out the states that are going bankrupt and, you know, the people that are losing their jobs because of, the companies wanting more money, profit and everything like that, send it overseas to get, the cheap labor and then still sell it for the same price they sell it here.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, Tom, that one of the problems, I remember now what I was going to say, Michigan is really kind of screwed because I said earlier that what they ought to do is rather than having this flat tax that really hurts poor people, a straight income tax and a straight sales tax, that it hurts the poorest, to have a higher graduated tax and even a higher corporate tax. But, we don't have any leverage anymore. These corporations would say, hey, you're raising our corporate tax. We're out of here. Maybe we'll go to another country. So, I mean, it's a system of blackmail where essentially we always come out on the short end of it. Ain't that sweet?
And you know what? I just feel like a moment of soapboxing and saying, if you are complacent in this and if this doesn't bother you, you need to light a fire underneath your rear end because this is serious stuff. And there are so many people who are I know you're busy. I know you have families. I know you have kids. But if you are not PO'd about what's going on, you need to get there now.
Yeah. I mean, and we're talking to each and, to each other and to everyone, not just to you, Tom. But thank you.
Oh, no, I wasn't talking to you, Tom.
All right. Thanks a lot,
Tom. I was talking to everyone who's complacent.
For joining. Well, part of it is, though, they're right now, they're what they call agency. There's no apparatus. There's no...
Is this like a 1984 kind of thing?
Well, what do we do? I mean, to say that everyone is PO'd, and I think most people are, what do we do? I mean, we have lost so far 800...
Something, Peter.
800
anything.
Billion. Yeah, well, what happens? I mean, why in Myanmar, for instance, where all these monks are out there, why did not this mass revolt happen... 6 months ago or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that happens and people just get pushed too far. I mean, why didn't the American Revolution happen in 1775 rather than 1776?
Yeah, that's true.
So I think there is a building sense that things can't go on like this anymore. I always look beneath the surface of things. I just saw this little teeny article in the New York Times the other day. It says to commemorate the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth and the 100th anniversary of the Lincoln penny, United States Mint, at the direction of Congress, will introduce four rotating coin designs for 2009 depicting different aspects of Lincoln's life. And I'm thinking, oh, that's nice. Those designs will replace the engraving of the Lincoln Memorial on the tail side of the coin. Lincoln's profile will remain on the front. So what's wrong with that? Why the hell do we have a penny?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, the penny creates so many problems.
Explain a couple of them, for example.
That you have to, the errors in math that occur regularly, because things are 1759 and 4621, and mm-hmm. so trying to add all this stuff up. I mean,
it's much more complicated.
Yeah, so things are much more complicated. If you just had zeros and fives, think mm-hmm. about how easier it would be.
Sure.
So why do we keep having the penny? Well, some of the, what do they call, what are the coin collectors, numis?
I don't know. I do not know.
Yeah, you know.
Someone will write it in.
Numis, something. Anyway,
I just call them coin collectors.
And coin collectors. That's what I was trying to say.
Okay.
And calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And that will, you can write us.
Let us know.
Anyway.
It's an amazing audience. They always give us the info.
Yeah. So probably a lot of it's tradition. And I just found like a penny from 1937.
Really?
Yeah. You know, if you look at all your pennies, you'll find.
I do once in a while.
Right.
I was just saying, take a couple of phone calls. We're filling on up.
All right, I'll do it. But I'm willing to bet that the real reason that they continue the penny is for the copper mining industry.
Oh, God. Oh.
Because it does two things.
Light bulb!
Yeah, it does two things. One, of course, it's this mass market for copper.
God.
And since there's a limited amount of copper in the ground, it raises the overall price of copper.
Mm-hmm. I think you're onto something.
Okay. Well, no one's been waiting a real long time, but let's get some people. Here's Kevin in Rochester. Kevin, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
Now, I'm curious, either of you have any clue what's going to go on with the Secretary of State? I mean, my birthday is on the 5th, so that's this coming Friday. I have not renewed my tabs for my car yet.
Yeah, I need to go get mine, actually, get some more, there's something done over there. I'm worried, too.
I don't know. I'll tell you, Kevin, from what I understand, even if there was a shutdown and the Secretary of State's office is shut, and it's, if you're listening in other states, it's, what is it, motor vehicle,
registration?
Yeah, well, they have some other, they call it by another name in other states. But in any event, they said it would be at the discretion of the local police officer. And I think, well, you don't have to worry about the state cops because the majority of them would be off duty.
True.
In a state.
DMV, that's another one.
DMV, that's the Department of Motor Vehicles, mm-hmm. right. That what they have in Iowa?
I think that's what they have in Iowa there, Peter. Yeah.
And the Secretary of State's office would be closed, but it's not clear. It seems like they just passed a temporary budget, so it may be open tomorrow.
And I don't think anything's going to be closed for too long if it is.
Well, and my other thing is, though, is that there's obviously extra charges included when you don't renew by your birthday.
Yeah, well, there's no way they're going to do that to you. There's no way. And don't you have 30 days after your birthday?
I believe it's by your birthday, because I think last year I was a little bit late and I ended up having to pay the extra 10 or 20 bucks.
Well, you know what? If they shut it down, no way are they going to make you pay for that.
All right, Kevin.
That's my prediction.
Yeah, it's hers, ours.
My
hers.
Strong prediction.
Hers. All right, thanks, Kevin.
Peter wants no part of it.
313-298-WRIF. It's Mark in Port Huron. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey.
Yeah, I gave that already. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter and Jolene? It's nice to talk to you again.
Thank you, Mark.
What I'd like to know is, did the legislatures in our government, did they give up their perks like their cars to and from work, their gas cards? What about the senators that have retired that are drawing a pension as we speak?
Yeah, are they going to put a hold on those?
$77,000 a year, and they're still working other jobs.
Sure.
But yet they're still drawing a pension, and I've been working since I was 8 years old, and I can't draw my pension until I'm 65.
They, well, as we know, politics is a sweet racket, not for you and me, but for those
right.
that, yeah. No, they're not going to. And many of that, of course, that's not going to cut into $1.5 billion, but it is symbolic. Of course, it is symbolic of them not being willing to take a hit themselves.
Right. It goes back to, like, the car companies. They, you know, had take cuts, but yet all the big shots get all these huge bonuses because they, you know, made it through their fiscal year.
And you know what, Mark? It happens every time.
And it happens every time.
Very consistent.
And we consistently sit and take it. And like you said earlier, the breaking point. What is our breaking point? Mine's now.
I'm
so sick of government, but I can't even, you know, I don't even want to talk about government other than the you guys.
Okay, well, we're the best sounding board for you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling.
All right, here is the current article from the Detroit Free Press online. Deadline: budget deal now hangs on Senate vote on tax bills. Granholm won't sign deal till Senate approves tax bills. This is updated at midnight. The House tonight voted 57 to 52 to raise the state income tax from 3.9 to 4.35%, a keystone to an overall budget agreement that would avert a state government shutdown on Monday. Well, it's already Monday. Minutes before midnight, Granholm spokeswoman Liz Boyd said the governor won't sign off on a deal until the Senate completes action on the income tax bill and a second bill approved earlier by the House to tax some services. State already has some components of shutdown in place before midnight. Some highway rest stops were barricaded. Campers were told to leave the state parks.
Unreal.
And at least one state, ready for this? At least one state drawbridge in Detroit has been placed in the up position and left unmanned.
I'm not very often speechless.
You can say the word. I've been using it all week. Unbelievable. This is unbelievable.
I'm breaking that habit. Tonight, what I'm going to say is, what in the hell?
Yeah. What is it? WTF.
Yes.
WTF. This is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it is.
The legislature clearly was planning to work past the deadline. Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, gee, thank you for overextending yourselves.
And try to charge us more money.
Yeah, right.
Right. Okay, here is more. Okay, here's David in Brighton. David, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey there. Thank you both very much. It's great to have Jolene back on, and I love you both.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, I... first off, I'm at least as left as you guys, I believe, basically, of going all the way except for abruptly nationalizing key industries. My question for you, right to the point, is this is an action point. This is an opportunity to actually perhaps, do something decisive as an intelligent populace who's in a democratic society, and do either of you or both of you have any suggestions as to what we can actually do, short of, peeing on the walls of the rest stops, or maybe that'll work, I don't know.
I said coffee can, Mark. Is this Mark?
That's cool. Should we leave the coffee cans there? I'm just giving you ideas. I mean, because I think action is occasionally.
Well, I do too. And if someone said to me, I often talk with this about people. People say that I've got these lofty goals. I've got this, and Jolene as well, and these all these criticisms of things as they are. What can I do tomorrow morning? What can I do on Monday morning? What can I do to begin to make a transformation in our lives, in our city, in our state, our country, in the world? What can I do to realize some of these goals? And I have to say, I'm not 100% sure that where I can send everyone, because I don't think the way is clear yet. I mean, a lot of the groups that I take part in and Jolene takes takes action with. They're good and they're decent, and they but they have to take on a mass character to the point where when people look back, depending on how old we all are in the scheme of things, that when we look back here in 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years, that this is an historic period, the way the 60s were, the way the 30s were, and a lot of us don't remember, unless you know a lot about history, about the 1890s or the 1850s for the, you know, the abolitionist movement, that this could really be an historic period that where things really change. And you're going to say, well, you're getting lofty again, Pete. I want some mechanics.
I want answers.
I want mechanics. I want a to-do thing. Well, I don't know, but here's what we're beginning to figure out, David. We're beginning to figure it out. We're beginning to realize that we're being looted. We're beginning to realize that our environment is going to hell. We're beginning to realize that not only are these elitists that rule this country and every country in the world, they're also doing an awful job of it, that they're screwing the world.
They'd like to make the world a one big corporation,
yeah,
ruled by them.
Yeah, and they would call it International General.
Yeah. I'm not an anarchist like you're referring to the 1890s and all that. I think that's too, you know, extreme. I believe there's a place, or a very heavy, important place for the government, and I believe that, you know, people should be able to have the choice to, exercise their rights to make money and all that kind of thing. But the over dominance of corporatism, as you say, is abominable. And yeah, I just want to let you know, and you already know this, I'm sure, from other listeners and callers, but I'll speak specifically to myself. There's 20 or 30 people right now who are listening to me speak to you both, who recognize my voice, who know who I am, who listen to your show but never call, and who have similar questions to the major one I posed. What specific action? And I know there's no easy answer, but thank you both very much.
All right, well, here's one of the things that I would suggest to everybody, is start taking part in non-official organizations.
There are so many. Go to PeterWorby.com and you can start. Peace Action, and it goes on and on and on. If it's the environment, join the Sierra Club. But I wanted to point out one thing, Peter, about that call, is that he said that he believes in having a government, in the government. But the problem is, the government doesn't not only believe in you as an individual, the government doesn't care about you as an individual. So why in the hell are you so supportive of government?
Yeah. Well, the other thing is,
and I'm not putting you down. I wasn't trying to be.
David?
Yeah.
David's gone.
I know, but I'm not trying to be.
No, I understand. When you say things like that, it's not aimed at the particular call.
No.
For instance, though, there's lots of stuff that are going on. Like right now, the real critical time for unions. If you're in a union, and the few of us that are left in them, take part in them. If at churches, at local churches, a lot of them have social justice committees, a lot of the liberal churches.
Right, a lot of the Catholic churches.
A lot of Catholic churches do. There's environmental groups. And you know what happens? You know what happens when you go to these meetings? Some of them are boring, and you're thinking, why did I even come here and all that?
You get something out of it, even if you're bored sometimes.
One of the things that it does, it gets you just from stopping and watching television, and gets you out with your neighbors, with co-thinkers. And just like, for instance, when you go out, you know, I'm always talking about, I play handball on Tuesday nights. Yeah, I love to play handball. We love the games. There's sometimes as much as 10 or 12 of us. It's, you know, great. But
one exercise, then you go have dinner
after,
right?
Yeah, that it becomes also a social event. Same thing like with softball. Those leagues are what about having beers after?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or during.
So one of the and it's not so awful, because in fact it's the opposite of awful. It's reconstructing civil society rather than us being split as these fragments of society. So we can be easily ruled by the elites. It means people coming together that have a collective voice to say first no, and then figure out what we want to say yes about. You're right, Julian. We've got to take a break. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10. Exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101-WRIF. Everything that rocks. with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Joined by Jalene Jordan. Now, we had a couple, I only told you about one of them, a couple of very strange emails.
Really?
One of them was from Steve, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, who said, Jalene, come down. I don't know whether he meant calm down.
He said come down?
Come down. What does that mean?
Okay, well, if it means calm down.
Yeah.
No! why, after everything we're talking about, would I be calm? I won't calm down. In fact, I'm just going to get louder and I'm going to get crazier. There you go.
Okay, so they're telling you to come down or calm down. Now, how about this?
Garrett, too bad.
Garrett writes in, Peter, are you on antidepressants or something?
Why? Because we're so happy?
Nah.
Yeah, I mean, because you're so happy?
Maybe in contrast
at times?
Or something like that. Well, Garrett, right back. Why do you think I'm on antidepressants?
Yeah, please.
I know a lot of people are on antidepressants, but it ain't me, babe.
Nope, and it ain't
no,
me
no,
either.
No, no, no.
Nope. Natural.
But he also wrote some other stuff. Oh, man.
Did he tell me to come down?
No, no, but kind of a little filled with... when will our passivity end? Look around you, people. It doesn't get worse than this. But then he says, rather violent line. But I'm not going to read that one.
Okay.
Peter, because it is a little violent. Oh, April writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We're talking about the fancy word for coin collectors. It's numismatism.
Okay.
Okay.
I never knew that.
All right. Well, I'd seen the word. I just, one of those things I don't think I ever
Thank
pronounced.
You.
I don't know if I pronounced it correctly. But remember I was saying that my theory was that they were going to reissue this penny and they keep it in order to support...
The copper mining industry.
Boy, was I off the wall, according to April.
Oh. It
says the penny hasn't been made of copper since 1982.
What is it made of?
I don't know. Zinc, maybe. There was a, you know, during World War II, there was a 1942 penny that I think was made of zinc. It was like silver color, but not real bright. But the,
yeah.
Because they stopped making because they needed copper for the war effort.
Well, sometimes we're wrong, Peter.
Yeah.
We'll admit it.
Well, I'm glad you say we. Currently, there's a ban on melting pre-1982 pennies and modern nickels because of the metal content. It costs nearly 7 cents to mint a 5 cent piece. WTF. Jesus.
Oh, yeah. So you are one of those, how do you say it? She's one of those
numismatics.
Numismatics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Makes me kind of want to sneeze.
Numismatics.
Or something, yeah. Maybe the same thing from Jason. Yeah, you want to come up with a conspiracy theory, check your facts. Oh, no, listen, Jason, conspiracy theorists do not check their facts, and I refuse to be held to that. Serious collectors will use pennies minted prior to 1982 because after they began 99.2% zinc with a 0.8%
copper. Oh, so you're right about zinc.
Yeah, so it's mostly zinc. And pre-1982 pennies, the percentage was 95% copper. If you want to come up with a conspiracy theory, check your facts. Why? I'll be like every other conspiracy theorist.
Dude, we're so stuck in the 70s.
Yeah, right. Okay, where are we on this? Here is Mike in Fairhaven. Mike, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you know, I'm former military, and I've traveled all over the United States. I've lived in approximately 20 different states. I've never once lived in a state with this many problems. Not once.
Wow.
And, I mean, on top of all that, you have to look at what this is going to do to the economy in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, it's not going to make it look like a great place to bring jobs and investment, is it?
No. Well, not only that, you have to think of how many people are on welfare from the state.
How many what?
You're kind of cutting out.
How many people are on welfare from the state?
Not very many.
Don't you know that Bill Clinton wiped out welfare?
There's not a lot of welfare left. Most of the people on welfare are dependent children,
women,
disabled.
And children.
Yeah, yeah, and
disabled
elderly.
Elderly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, one of my ex-girlfriends, her son is on state assistance.
Uh-huh.
And she received notification that she will probably lose all assistance for her son.
Wow.
Now, she makes $7 an hour.
Wow.
She's, I mean, how many other people is this going to affect?
That's right, and this is what we're talking about here on this program.
Yeah, what are the priorities here? Well, I'll tell you, there is sort of the capitalist wheel of misfortune and fortune, fortune and misfortune. So different periods in U.S. history, different states and different areas of the country are blessed or cursed. And, of course, like in the 1940s, 1950s, Michigan, boy, this was an incredible economy. It was the place to be for the average worker and like an auto worker and what have you. And, man, if you were in Mississippi, of course, Mississippi still is in the pits. It still is the poorest state. But it seems like, Michigan is giving it a run for its money, which ain't good. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Here is Josh in Waterford. Josh, you going to tell me the same thing about the penny?
Well, yeah, she kind of burst my bubble on that penny thing about the actual materials the penny are made from cost more than the penny itself, which is kind of depressing. It burst my bubble.
Well, here, Josh. No, it's okay.
We're so sorry.
But you know what, Josh? Here's my – I got a new conspiracy theory, and that is it's the zinc manufacturers that are behind it all.
I knew you could turn that around.
Did I say copper? I meant zinc.
What do you think?
There you go.
What do you think?
About zinc.
Seriously.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense that we have the penny. It really doesn't. It's a waste of time and money, literally, to have a penny.
Yeah, yeah.
Down with pennies.
Down with pennies. One of our major reforms. All right, thank you. And let's see, is this the same thing? Michael from Detroit. More on pennies, Michael?
Yeah, actually, a little bit build up on your conspiracy theory, and which might blow your nickels right away right now, is the pennies themselves, the reason that they're out there is because the government taxes us on these weird percents, you know, like 6%, 8%. And so they're getting these little pennies, these 1 and 2 cents that add up to millions and billions of dollars each year.
Oh.
So they're never going to give up those little tiny pennies. Otherwise, we're going to end up paying them nickels instead of pennies. And I'd rather pay them pennies than nickels.
Well, okay. Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Thank you. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Their little minds are always working.
And you weren't talking about that caller. Their little minds.
No. The people in government.
Thank you.
The taxers. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Mick in Utica. Mick, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just got back from playing handball.
Right on. Well, you got a party going on?
Yeah. No, I think he's got his radio up.
Dinner after? Are you having dinner after handball like Peter does?
Okay.
Turn your radio down a little bit, please.
Off,
I mean. Yeah.
Thank you. The taxes. 313.
I think he's listening to himself.
Yeah. I'm going to give him a chance.
Yeah, we'll put you on hold. We'll bring you back in.
Although he may have...
turn the radio off.
Yes. Yeah, Mick, turn the radio off. Here's Robert in Jackson. Robert, hi. You're on the air. Hey, you're going to lose a prison, aren't you?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, they're going to close Jackson, the famous Jackson prison.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Did you hear me? Yeah.
It's going to make Jackson an even worse place to live once all those people get out.
So what's on your mind tonight?
They're not they're not letting the people. Oh, you know what they ought to do? They ought to. If you want to save some money, they ought to release all the nonviolent drug offenders.
Well, I agree with you, Peter.
Well, all right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Whatever. Line 4. Larry is calling from Canada. Thanks for making our show international. Larry, where are you calling from in Canada?
I'm phoning from Vancouver.
Really?
I phoned you, a month ago or so.
Oh, yeah, right.
Welcome back.
Oh, yeah, I do see. It says VC Canada.
You've got a good show, and once again, you've got a good website as well.
Well, thank you, Larry.
I have two questions for you.
Yeah.
In Canada, we have... more like with the war in Afghanistan,
right?
But I never hear the media here, or even in the States, ever really measure whether there's democracy there or not. And I'm wondering, other than say Amnesty International, are there any websites or any media that actually measure whether there's democracy in all these different countries? And then my second question is, I'm just wondering. Pretty soon, you'll be having the debates with the Democrats and the Republicans.
Right, including one here in Detroit. No, that's Republicans are coming here to Dearborn, Michigan. That ought to be fun.
I'm just wondering, which do you think any of the Democratic candidates Do you think any of them can win back any of those red states, or, you know, so-called red states? And then which one do you think we could win those red states back?
I think almost any of them could. But the Democrats are so lame that...
Except for Dennis Kucinich,
yeah, that they could probably snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Right.
But the first one, measuring democracy, there are. It sounds familiar. I'm not aware of.
I have an answer.
Go ahead.
There is no democracy over there. You can't find anything because it's non-existent. And if you read something that there is democracy, can you say that for me, Peter?
Democracy
in Iraq.
No, well, not Iraq, Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, anywhere over there, it's not. You're reading misinformation.
Yeah, well, no, he didn't. He was wondering whether there was.
I'm saying there's not.
It's impossible, given the circumstances in Afghanistan. You know, interestingly, during the week, my wife and I went to spend a night in a little place up in...
Canada,
in Ontario, on Lake Huron. And I was talking with this woman that ran it, and she said her son had broken all these bones in his foot. He was like 17 years old in a sporting accident, and he had to wait 2 weeks before she could get surgery. So I said, well, I don't know. I said, did you ever see Michael Moore's Sicko? He really is pretty high on the Canadian system. I said, what's your thought of it? And she said, well, it's because of the Prime Minister, Harper, and the way that they've diverted funds away from the medical system in Canada, and that it's underfunded. So I said, you know, I have a talk show in Detroit, and I said, I always advocate that there's no reason for Canada to have an army whatsoever, and that you can, that billions and billions and billions are spent on the Canadian army, where the only country that would ever invade Canada is the United States, and there's no way in the world that Canada could stand up to it. So they ought to go the route of Costa Rica, which also does not have an army at all. So my proposal is disband the Canadian army, use those billions of dollars that are being wasted by the Canadian military, and use it for social programs.
That also brings up an interesting point, because you're mentioning the movie Sicko with Michael Moore.
Yeah.
In his movie Fahrenheit 9/11,
right.
He actually mentioned that the leader of Afghanistan, Karzai,
mm-hmm. right.
that was affiliated somehow or was a consultant to UNICAL.
Right, the Texas oil firm.
Yeah, so you kind of have to wonder, you know, what, you know, the war in Afghanistan was all about and what the war with, you know, Iraq was all about.
You're so polite. Canadians are so polite, aren't they Peter?
In Michael Moore's movies, he always has the Canadians. And in fact, do you ever see Michael Moore's film called Canadian Bacon?
I saw it two or three times.
Okay.
But,
here's a fan. Well, yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's about oil. That's all that it's about. This is all that it's about. In fact, you know, we're complaining here. When I was in Canada, it was in the, what, 90s, what is it, about 96 cents a liter in Canada now, so about $4 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
we had a lady, she was speaking at a political convention up here, and she was in the Afghanistan parliament,
mm-hmm.
and she was saying that other than, you know, the drug lords and the warlords.
Yeah.
I mean, even though she's in the parliament, she has a lot of hostility from these people. So I'm just wondering, you know, who's measuring the democracy? I mean, the media doesn't seem to be doing it.
No, they certainly don't. Well, let me, you know, I was thinking about the cost of gas. Gas now, I think I just got it for $2.86 a gallon. Our gas is really probably $18, $19 a gallon. When you factor into it the military efforts, because that's what this is all about.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
You know, our friend Billy Bragg, the folk singer.
Yes.
He's got a
it's all about the price of oil.
All about the price of oil. And so we're spending this $2 trillion.
Yeah, it's much deeper than just getting the oil. It's about the price.
Ooh, guess what? We got to go.
Huh.
Larry, thanks. Man, I'm sorry to leave all you people stranded.
We need another hour. Wait, you have one. There's a couple interviews coming up.
Let me see if I can remember who's on. And I wanted to talk about, I never got to this, Frank Joyce, who's a labor communications consultant, talking about the UAW-GM settlement.
Fabulous. He's wonderful.
Yeah.
I know Frank.
And I had a lot to say about that. Also, Francis Moore LePay, who wrote Died for a Small Planet years and years ago.
I own that.
Who was instrumental in changing my diet. She's got a book out called Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad, which speaks to many of the things that we were talking about tonight. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. You willing to do this again next week?
Sure, Julie? Peter.
All right.
Count on it. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, Al, our producers.
And thanks to all of you.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF presents the return of the Riff's Trigger Free Concert featuring Hell Yeah. Hell Yeah, with special guest O-Tip and Blood Simple. October 30th at the Fillmore Detroit. Devil's Night has never rocked so hard in the D. Come rock with a Riff. Check out the vendor village inside the Fillmore and get in on the Trigger Free Costume Contest with a $1,000 grand prize. Tickets for the Riff Trigger Free Bash are just $2,101. On sale right now at all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666 or Ticketmaster.com. October 30th, the Fillmore rocks. The Riff's Trigger-Free Concert, featuring Hell Yeah. From who else but your concert station in the Motor City. 101 WRIF. Every day rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As you know, I frequently have friends of mine on this show, people that have taken a lifetime to look at different aspects of our society. Rarely, though, do I get to interview somebody who has had such an impact on me over the years. And I speak this time of Frances Moore LePay. Her books, Diet for a Small Planet, had an extreme impact on the kind of food I've eaten all for the rest of my life since they were written and published in the early 1970s. But Frances Moore LePay has done much much more beyond her books, although they've sold in the millions, been translated into 20 languages. She co-founded the Institute for Food and Development Policy, Food First, and that's in its 32nd year. The American News Service, which operated from 1995 to 2000, and Frances Moore LePay has appeared on The Today Show, PBS Now, All Things Considered, and The Diane Rehm Show, and her articles have appeared in Harper's, The Oprah Magazine, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, People Magazine, and so many more that I think I would spend too much time introducing her. Frances Moore LePay, thank you for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
What a great delight for me, Peter.
Well, it was just wonderful when I saw your book, Diet for a Small Planet, and I read it. And I remember distinctly that night when we were having liver and onions for dinner, and I had this huge calf's liver in my hands, washing it off under the sink, under the tap, and I said, "This is it. That's it for meat and me." So I want to thank you for that. It had an extreme impact on my life. But before we get into your brand new book, Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad, can you draw us kind of a line from that book, from the books about diet, to a book about our whole world, Getting a Grip?
Well, I had to figure out why hunger in a world of plenty. And that set me on quite a journey. And pretty soon I figured out that hunger is not caused by scarcity of food, but a scarcity of democracy is the way that I summed it up. But I meant by that there's plenty of food in the world, in fact, enough to make each of us chubby, and there still is. What hunger is caused by is a lack of democracy. What I mean by that is the denial of people's voice so that they can express their interest. And, of course, our first interest is in eating and feeding our offspring. So that really is how I got to where I am today in writing this book, Getting a Grip.
Do you think others saw that linear progression as well, or did they, like beginning with Diet for a Small Planet, which is an analysis of the food we eat, but is also just terrific recipes and a book still in print, and there's a follow-up?
Yes, I wrote with my daughter a sequel called Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet, and that was really the mountaintop experience of my life traveling the world with my daughter, who was exactly the age that I was when I wrote my first book. So I've been on this journey for a while, and Getting a Grip is really the distillation of what I, in my attempt to get a grip and to share that with others, that really believing that most people recognize that the planet is in big trouble, and we've got to be able to identify what are the underlying causes of the suffering and the devastation of nature and our lives, our daily lives, through the great stress that we're under. Now, how do we analyze root causes so that we can feel that we're actually reversing those toward health? Otherwise, we feel that our acts are just kind of, you know, grasping at straws, or sometimes I call it random acts of sanity, that, you know, it might feel good at the moment, but we don't really see how it adds up to anything. And so this is a book about how does it add up to something, because we can really see the root causes and pinpoint them and reverse the negative.
Well, I think everyone, as a matter of course, maybe it's even rooted in our sociobiology, we're addicted to the now, to what we find in front of us, generally trying to make the best of it. I know there's a lot of people that try to make the worst of it for themselves and others, but most of us try to make the best of it. But when people are trying to break addiction, one of the problems always is a denial of the person that's having the addiction. And I was noticing in your subtitle of Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. I don't know that everyone would share your view. I do, that the world has gone mad. But is that do you think that's a problem, that we don't recognize the state we're in?
I do, in a way. I mean, I think that the epidemic of depression is one symptom of what you're talking about, because I think when we're denying what we know, it is depressing. And I think many of the diseases that we are encountering, the expansion of today, relate to that depression. And I think that when people feel powerless, they maybe can feel better to stay in denial because if you really faced up to what's going on, then you'd know that you couldn't do anything. So my response to that is, wait a minute, we're not powerless. We don't have to remain in depression. We don't have to deny the best of ourselves. And that, look, here is what we are doing, those of us who are breaking out of that depression and just sense of despair. So I think that can be contagious too, that I do agree with you. There's a lot of denial. But as we see our neighbors sort of stepping out and taking risks and becoming more alive, then that will give a lot of those of us in denial the courage to do the same.
Well, in your book, it's wonderfully, besides what the words in it, it's also wonderfully laid out, it's wonderful design. And in the front cover and in the back cover, the inside covers, you have the spiral of powerlessness and the spiral of empowerment. I don't know if you have the book in front of you or you can do this.
Yes, I could do it in my sleep.
Okay, tell us the spiral of powerlessness, because that's what leads to so many of the maladies of this world, maybe all of them.
Well, I honestly think that we've bought this line that human beings can be reduced to this caricature, that we're nothing but, you know, you can peel away the fluff around the edges, and then we're nothing but these grubby little materialists, you know, out to get more stuff, competitive and material and looking out for number one. And with that kind of dim view of ourselves, then we come to believe that, of course, we're incapable of coming together and creating a society that works for all of us and getting money out of politics and really stepping up and deliberating over what's good for the whole country, the whole world. And we then give over our fate to others. We give over our fate to this impersonal law that John D. Rockefeller called it the law of God and of nature. Ronald Reagan called it the magic of the market, this idea that there's some, you know, magical force out there called the market that's going to just decide outcomes, and then we are really stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we end up what I call the one rule economy, the highest return to existing wealth, that is the shareholders, that's the one rule. So wealth inexorably concentrates, then it infects the political system. 61 lobbyists now in Washington for every person that you and I voted to elect to represent us. And so then you have, yes, you have billions of dollars in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry that's polluting and you know, heating our planet. And then you start seeing the affirmation of your assumption that you started with, which is that all we are these grubby, you know, materialists out to get ours. And so it's a spiral. It's a vicious circle that then we start going downhill, then people give up, and they say, oh, yeah, people are just, you know, this narrow, shabby caricature. So it is really time to say, wait a minute, we can stop debating whether human beings are good or bad. Clearly, we can be both. And so what my book is all about is saying, we can even now know because of neuroscience experiments that there are these, we don't have to debate that human beings are good of their nature, but we can certainly say that there is enough goodness in us that we can tap. And I love the experiments now showing these hardwired needs for fairness, for cooperation, for power, for efficacy in the world. So these are things that we all have in us if our society will call on that. And how, my question is then, how do we move from this dangerous, thin democracy that is concentrating power and move to a living democracy in which people are creating new power through their own engagement? And it's happening, Peter. This is not my, you know, fantasy dream. This is real.
Well, let's examine that a little, because although my Tai Chi teacher would hate me for this formulation, she wouldn't hate me, she would hate the formulation, to say, I used to think there's like two-thirds good people in the world and one-third bad. That's the formulation she would, you know, shake her head at and what have you. But and that third has a grip on that concentrated power, that concentrated wealth, that often uses it for malign purposes. And yet they are so powerful and they, it seems like they don't sleep, where most of us, as you said, want to provide for our families. We want an exciting and interesting life, and we're not interested in, and you maybe should speak about this word, we're not interested in power, certainly not power over. We want the power to have a decent life and what have you. But this other third is interested in power over, and throughout history has barely been hurtful to the majority of people on the planet and the planet itself.
Well, that's a really interesting way of looking at it, and it's. But I mean, even say taking your formulation just as it is, the real question, we can't blame. Say, I won't argue with your math, right? We'll just say this third, right? Okay. We can't really blame them if the majority, the two-thirds, are letting it happen. And we're letting it happen because I argue, and there's a chapter in Getting a Grip about fear, and I argue that we're letting things happen that violate our deepest common sense and our deepest values and just hearts because we're afraid of conflict. We're afraid of being different because we evolved in community, in tribes, in which separating from the pack was really dangerous. It could mean death. And we're so social. This is the best in us that we want to be liked. And so we don't want to be critical or be stand out from the crowd. We want to fit in. And I'm saying now the stakes are too high, that you and I, all of us, have to learn that we can walk with our fear of difference, and actually it's exhilarating. It's, yes, you know, it is scary to speak up and to step out of your comfort zone and be involved in things that matter to you, but it's also exhilarating, and it gets us out of our depression, and it gets us into friendships with people. You know how they always say, well, people who go to war together, you know, one of the only positive things you could say about battle is that it creates these bonds. I mean, this is what I read anyway, among people who are fighting. Well, the kinds of bonds that get created among people who are working for a common purpose to make their communities better is so rewarding. So I think that we can't focus on the them, even if I did agree with you, because really it's up to all of us who don't want power over, but want to manifest power over other people, you know, negative power over other people, but just want power to create a world that works for our families, our neighborhoods, for other people, as well as ourselves. That takes some courage, and that's why courage is the last section of my book. And I tell the stories of people who have found that in themselves, that they can walk with their fear of difference and find it, that their lives are just transformed for the better.
The book is Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. The author is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, Francis Moore LePay. You can go to gettingagrip.org, and also I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. And give us some examples.
Well, let me just give you an example of somebody who I think, you know, I talked about the spiral and how do you just break it and start reversing it into the spiral of empowerment. One of my heroes in the book is Marge Mead, a grandma in Arizona who kind of stumbled into, well, she moved into a new city in Arizona and she didn't know people, so she went to a League of Women Voters meeting and their secretary was missing or something. Anyway, she got called in to take minutes. She decided they needed minutes and they weren't even taking them, and she knew shorthand, so she started taking minutes. She was so intimidated by what she was hearing because it was all about a new law to get money out of politics in Arizona and to make clean elections where there's no significant private money involved at all. And she got fascinated by this, and she was so fascinated that she said, I became reincarnated as a political activist. But she went to church basements and rotary clubs, and she talked about this legislation and became one of the state's experts. And then this law passed, and now she is seeing it working. Now in two states, Maine and Arizona, where Marge lives, money is virtually out of the system. 80% of those who run for office run without private money, in other words, without corporate backing. So they'd have after they're elected, they answer to the citizens rather than to some private interests. And so my son, a filmmaker, Anthony LaPay, has just made a short film that's going to be on that website that you just mentioned, gettingagrip.org. And it is a film about another hero of mine in Maine who was a waitress, high school educated, and decided she could run for office and has made a huge contribution after she won. So these are the stories about people who walked with their fear. I mean, Marge had no idea what she was getting into. And Deb in Maine, you know, when her friend said, you should run for office, she said, you're crazy. And then she said, wait a minute, I could do that. All I have to do is raise $5 from 50 people because they had clean elections. And we could do that in every state, and we could do it at a national level.
I think it's so important to emphasize the positive, and as saying that, I'm going to go back a little to the negative, and maybe, but you speak about that in your book, Getting a Grip, fear. I mean, because although certainly people do not like to be different or don't want to seem troublemaker or radical, even though, hey, troublemakers and radicals founded this country, right?
Right. That's what people forget.
Yeah.
Yes.
That fears also have to do with how the whole population, including us. I mean, we're not safe from it. The kind of manipulation of fears that come through the mass media that are sometimes are rooted in real events like 9/11 that get people have a tendency to walk in lockstep. Tell me about the process of overcoming fear.
Well, before I do, if you'll forgive me, I'd like to just make the point that, yes, fear is the emotional plague of our planet. I agree. But actually, if we are living our lives from the point of fear, I'm convinced that we end up creating what we most fear. And I learned that first with food. I learned our fear of scarcity actually ends up reducing the capacity of the earth to feed us, that we are wasting such enormous amounts of food in the world. 70% of agricultural land is growing livestock. And in this country, we feed most of what grows in the United States. We feed to animals. And if it's a beef cow that we're feeding, it returns only 1 pound in meat to us for every 16 pounds we feed. So what we look at the whole situation after 9/11, we fear terrorism, but what are we doing? I mean, what are we doing in this war on Iraq? We are actually giving reason for people to be more bitter, more angry, more righteously wanting to stand up against us, in fact, kill themselves in order to kill some of us. So we are actually generating what we fear. And if we come from that point, we will continue to do that. And so we have to learn not to be so afraid of fear. And what I mean by that is it took me a long time to get it. And I guess we don't have time in this radio interview to tell you the story. But in any case, I learned from a great teacher in Africa that fear is simply energy. It's not a verdict. When we feel that pounding heart, when we, you know, feel the cold sweat from fear, that's just information. And it could be that it's not telling us that we're in the wrong place, that we should fight or flee or freeze. It might be telling us that we are right at our growth edge and we should just keep walking. And over again, I keep learning this. And when I feel in a group that I'm out of step, now when I experience that pounding heart of feeling different, I've renamed it inner applause.
I like that.
And it works. And it tells me, rather than saying, oh, you're a wimp, why are you freaking out, you're a wimp, it says to me, oh, you are right on your edge, go for it. And it really has changed my whole sense of myself. I lived with a lot of fear a few years ago, and that gave me a whole new understanding when I really worked through it and realized it did not stop me, and it never will have to stop me.
At the beginning of the program, Frances Moore LaPay, I had you read from the what do you call those first pages? There's a word for it. The inside where you have the spiral of powerlessness. That's called the
I don't know.
The inside of the inside front cover.
Right.
We have
there
the spiral of powerlessness. And on the back cover, though, it has the spiral of empowerment. I wonder if you could go through those before our time runs out, because that overcomes that spiral of powerlessness.
Absolutely. I mean, it starts with this idea that it's not whether human nature is good, you know, the goodness of human nature, but the goodness in human nature. It's simply recognizing what is obvious to all of us, that we get pleasure from cooperation. Do you know that MRI studies of the brain show that when we're cooperating, that parts of our brains light up, that are the same parts that light up when we eat chocolate?
I love it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you know, even you know, animals in the animal kingdom surely were as sensitive and compassionate as rhesus monkeys, who will go for 12 days without eating if it means that they can avoid hurting their fellow monkey. I mean, it's amazing the evidence is now mounting about, and, you know, just our need for fairness in community. I mean, it's definitely hardwired in us, because we couldn't survive in communities. We understood that if things were unfair. So I'm saying let's start with that base, and then let's, from that, then we recognize that we can deliberate over how to use the tools of government and the economic tools of the market rather than being its victim. And we realize that government and the market economy are not enemies in competition, that it takes a democratic society, a democratic government, to make the market work. Otherwise, it turns into monopolies that we're seeing today, where there's just a few companies that control virtually every major industry. So it requires an open market where people can enter, where new parties can enter, and where everyone can participate. It requires a democratic government, and then we can start solving our problems, and that then reinforces this belief in the best in us. And so there's a virtuous cycle that operates once we walk with our fear and step up and speak out and gain the sense of power by listening to the best in us. And so that is my call in this book, that we know now what is necessary for society to bring out the best in us. And it starts with the widest dispersion of power, and the only way that's going to happen is as you and I step up and discover that power isn't something that somebody else has, that evil thing, that corrupt thing. It's what we can create together. Because power, when it goes back to its root in Latin, the meaning of power is simply to be able, the capacity to act. And so as my book is full of examples of people who've never been involved before in anything outside of their own workplace or family, who are stepping up and just finding it exhilarating to make a difference, like Marge and Deb, for example, in Maine, who, you know, who would have thought a waitress would now be co-chair of the Judiciary Committee in Maine.
Well, you have this hopefulness, which is really inspiring, because, as you said earlier, there's a general epidemic of depression. And among peace and social justice activists, there is this feeling of many people I speak to, of burnout, of, you know, no matter how many people we mobilize, the government keeps doing what it's doing. Things that have to be addressed aren't. But even one of your books you mentioned earlier, Hope's Edge. I mean, we could be on this cusp, eh? I mean,
yes. I mean, I think, by the way, I don't really consider myself an optimist. I consider myself a possibilist, meaning that I think it is possible that people are really waking up now that they see the consequences of the path that we're on, and now that human species has the history and we have the capacity to look back and to see where this path has taken us and what the conditions are that bring out the worst in us. And so it's really the piece that is, that we really have to work with then, is our own sense of capacity. That's the walking with our fears that maybe we can't make this turn, or walking with our fear of being different. And that's why I include all these stories of people who are finding their lives so enriched by actually moving into their discomfort zone and finding new parts of themselves as they discover they are not powerless. In fact,
They, in fact, you know, one of the points I make in the book throughout is that we all are creating the world moment to moment. So we have no choice as to not be world changers. We're all world changers. Even if we're doing nothing but going to work and coming home and sitting in front of the television, we are changing the world. We are reinforcing the spiral of powerlessness. So we are changing it in the direction of, I would say, death, to use a pretty inflammatory word, but that's my view. And so as we wake up and realize, no, we can speak out, then we are changing it in another way. But either way, we are changing it. And each of the choices we make, our purchases, for example, or where we put our retirement funds, all of those are sending out enormous ripples saying, for example, if we buy food that is drenched with pesticides in its production, we're saying to the world, oh, yeah, yeah, I want more of that. I want more of those chemicals that are polluting our rivers and waterways and harming our farm workers and farmers and even our own bodies. So, you know, we have power.
And we have Yeah, we have the choice of the spiral of empowerment that Frances Moore LePay writes about so eloquently in her brand new book, Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. You can go to gettingagrip.org for more information. It's published by Small Planet Media. That's at smallplanetmedia.org. These links will be on my site, peterwerby.com. The Washington Post says some of the 20th century's most vibrant activist thinkers have been American women. Margaret Mead, Jeanette Rankin, Barbara Ward, Dorothy Day, who took it upon themselves to pump life into basic truths. Frances Moore LePay is among them. It's been a pleasure to have you on my program. Thank you so much.
No, it's been my pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, jump away, leave me to myself, jump away.
101 WRIF presents the return of the Riff's Trigger Free Concert featuring Hell Yeah. Hell Yeah, with special guests O-Tip and Blood Simple. October 30th at the Fillmore Detroit. Devil's Night has never rocked so hard in the D. Come rock with a riff. Check out the vendor village inside the Fillmore and get in on the Tricker Free Costume Contest with a $1,000 grand prize. Tickets for the Riff Tricker Free Bash are just $2,101. On sale right now at all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666 or Ticketmaster.com. October 30th, the Fillmore rocks. The Riff's Tricker Free Concert featuring Hell Yeah. From who else but your concert station in the Motor City. 101 WRIF. Every day rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. As I think most of you know by now, on Thursday, United Auto Workers and the General Motors Corporation tentatively agreed to a contract that ends a two-day strike. It's the first nationwide walkout against the automaker in 37 years and has a lot of aspects to it that affect not just the 73,000 GM workers, but most of us in southeastern Michigan here, and maybe an impact on the world economy, industrialism in the United States, and all of that. And there's nobody I can think of better to comment, both specifically in general, and then Frank Joyce. He's the former director of public relations for the United Auto Workers and currently a labor communications consultant. He's a Detroiter, lives in Detroit, but we're reaching him in California. Frank Joyce, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm good. And we should say, what is that, full disclosure? We're old friends. Yes, we both worked for the United Auto Workers. In fact, you pretty much hired me in 2000, where I worked for the broadcast division from 2000 to 2003. I'm a longtime member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, so I have a particular bias and stuff about union and all that. Frank Joyce, tell us, were there winners and losers in this strike?
Well, I think UAW members are winners in this strike for sure. When you stop and think about how tough the conditions are for all unions, including the UAW at this point, when you think about how tough the conditions are for the Detroit Three in the global automotive industry, this agreement, from what we can understand about it, is a pretty remarkable achievement. It's an agreement that is aligned with reality, and that reality, of course, is that conditions are tough for these companies, and the union is weaker than it has been in the past. And as I say, that's part of what makes some of these achievements that we're hearing about all the more remarkable.
Well, one of the things, usually new contracts almost always carry some small percentage of increase, yet there's no wage increase in this package that's been bargained for.
Well, as I don't have a lot of inside, I have virtually no inside information on contract details, so I'm relying on the same press accounts that everybody else has seen. But if it's the case that there is a signing bonus and annual lump sum payments, on the one hand, it's true that that's not the base wage rate increase that UAW members at the Big Three, at any rate, have traditionally enjoyed. But it's also not accurate to say that there are no wage increases whatsoever. People will be getting more money in their pocket each year of this agreement. And I think the no base wage increase is reflective of this aligning with reality dynamic that was at work in these negotiations, because the fact of the matter is GM and Ford and Chrysler are competing globally, and in particular are competing with the transplant operations in the United States. And the compensation, the labor costs at those facilities are dramatically lower for a variety of reasons. And wage rate increases at those, for those workers, are not guaranteed. A lot of their compensation comes from bonuses and sort of a virtual form of profit sharing, I guess. In any case, the UAW GM members
will get more money in their pocket every year of this agreement, as I understand it.
Now, Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, who was once both our employer, he said that this is going to guarantee jobs for GM workers. And that's certainly the concern that almost everyone in the United States has today, this sense of our jobs being very, very precarious, no matter where we are, white-collar, blue-collar, whatever. Are we going to have our jobs in a year? Are we going to have benefits in a year? From what you can read in the press accounts, and I should tell people, we are broadcasting recording this maybe 12 hours after the settlement has been announced. So my guest, Frank Joyce, has said he is looking at press accounts and making an analysis from that. But does it look, from your reading, like there is going to be some guarantee of jobs here at General Motors?
I do think that you have to take that with a grain of salt and skepticism, because job security, as you just said, has been so important to many workers and UAW members in particular for a long time. Politically, that's been a priority in negotiations for a long time. The reality is that there is only so much that you can contractually assure to secure jobs, and the reality is that despite job security being the number one priority of every set of negotiations for at least the last probably 10 UAW Big Three, or now Detroit Three negotiations, employment at all of these companies is dramatically lower. And membership in the UAW that's representing workers at these companies is dramatically lower. You can't change the economic laws of gravity, and as these companies lose market share and lose sales and adopt new labor-saving technology, employment is going to go down. Now, it may be that this is the time when there's a plateau, as Mr. Gettelfinger has said, of 73,000 or so GM employees that he expects will still be the number 4 years out. Maybe that's true, but if so, that'll be a first, because every year we've heard about job security guarantees for at least the last 15 or 20 years. At the end of an agreement, there were dramatically fewer workers covered by that agreement than there were before. So it's also, let me add one other thing that you touched on and is absolutely accurate. It is a struggle to preserve investment and jobs in the United States, especially in manufacturing, because capital is very mobile and labor costs elsewhere are very low. So the attraction for companies to move work outside the United States is intense, and that's not going to change one tiny bit in the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, when analysts estimate that foreign automakers, this is with U.S. manufacturing operations, still pay $20 to $30 less per hour than General Motors, and that we've heard this figure a number of times, that translates into, I like that you called the Detroit Three, no longer the Big Three, that the Detroit Three now are sometimes almost at a $2,000 disadvantage to foreign automakers. So that really is what has driven in many ways this Voluntary Employee Beneficiary Association, this VEBA, which would be an independent healthcare trust that was decided upon. And I'm not quite clear. This was something that healthcare costs were going to be shifted to the UAW, to the union. And on the other hand, is it Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, said, no, they're not going to administer it.
The idea was always that this would be, and again, I don't know the details, but that this will be at least a quasi-independent operation. It will have its own board of directors and its own management executives, if you will, and there will doubtless be a number of seats on that board for UAW representation, and I don't rule out that there are spaces on that board for company representation as well. But again, I don't know those details. That doesn't change the fact that this is a significant shift for the UAW, however. This is an adaptation to the new economic reality that the union finds itself in. insofar as historically, and this hasn't always been true of all unions, Teamsters most notably, as we know, have been very involved in the direct management of some of the benefit funds that pay for benefits for their members. This is not unprecedented. The UAW has agreed to VEBAs with other employers previously on a smaller scale, but on this scale and with General Motors at this level, this is a qualitative change in how the UAW operates.
It doesn't seem bad on the face of it, as long as the benefits for these men and women that have worked so hard over the years continue to get their pensions is and their health care taken care of. Is this put their benefits less at jeopardy or more at jeopardy, or is it a wash? Sounds almost like a wash.
Well, I think that we don't know the answer to that. One thing that I do know that was on the table as a part of these conversations, and one bigger picture question to pay attention to here is, let me reframe what you just asked. Does this create more incentives or less incentives for companies like GM, Ford, and Chrysler to either actively support or at least not get in the way of more fundamental health care reform? Because without that, we're all in trouble. And no union, we're all prisoners, if you will, of a system of employer-based health care that the UAW reluctantly helped create many, many years ago. Walter Reuther was very clear at the time. He said, you know, this isn't the best way to do this. The best way to do this is national health care. But given that that's not attainable, he set off on a course of working people in this country coming to depend on their employer for health care. That's a fundamentally dumb idea, in my opinion. And it's much smarter to pool all the risk in a society and administer health care in a much more efficient way than this Jerry-built claptrap of a system that we have now. I know that on the table were some conversations about creating some funds to support more fundamental health care reform, and I hope that there's attention being paid to that, because even if, I mean, I don't doubt for a minute that this fund will guarantee the benefits of the workers it covers for another 4 years. But long term, the American healthcare system can't go on like it is. It's nuts. It's inefficient, and it's ineffective.
My guest in the Peter Werbe Show is Frank Joyce. He's a labor communications consultant, was the former director of the United Auto Workers, a former public relations director of the United Auto Workers for years. In fact, Frank, you held that, didn't you, longer than anyone else in the history of the union?
It's a dubious distinction, but it's a distinction nevertheless. this is not just my opinion. It's not the easiest job that there is at the UAW.
No.
Let's put it that way.
I could imagine. So the way you've been portraying the UAW General Motors tentative agreement still has to be voted upon by the members, of course, and ratified. I suspect that it will be, that I hate to use cliches like this, but it sounds to some extent like a win-win situation. It would be the best that could be eked out under the circumstances as you defined it earlier.
Right. I think nobody's more realistic than the members, and I think we saw that again and again when they were quoted both before the strike and during the strike. They do understand what the economic realities of our time were, and I think that they'll perceive that this agreement, as I said before, is in alignment, and in some ways maybe even more than what some would have thought possible. I do want to, there is a fly in the ointment here, however, that I want to at least identify, and again, it's from a more long-range, bigger picture question. I wouldn't hesitate one tiny bit as a UAW member to vote for this agreement, as I understand it, or to recommend that others do so as well. The bigger question, however, is that this agreement, as good as it may be, continues a trend in which the UAW every 3 or now every 4 years is basically negotiating to catch up with a new reality, and a reality that's harder and more difficult to deal with than the one before. The question is there going to come some kind of turnaround and some kind of leapfrogging that gets over the problems of lost sales, lost market share, lost membership that have characterized, as I said before, the UAW and the now Detroit 3 for at least 20 years now, and that remains to be seen at best.
Now, the strike, the two-day strike that just occurred, was that just window dressing, or do you think it had an effect on negotiations?
I think it had an effect on the negotiations. To put what I said a minute ago in a slightly different way, no one should think that it's easy to find the balance that's been struck here between a union that's in deep trouble and companies that are in deep trouble that advance the interests of both institutions and of the members and constituents and, to use a term of art, the stakeholders in all of these outfits. So it's not surprising to me that it took a short strike to kind of refocus things that apparently had gone off track. And it's a healthy sign, in my view. Strikes are dangerous for unions and workers these days, and any union that can pull one off of any duration is to be congratulated. And that doesn't mean that the strike isn't still a diminished weapon, and it doesn't mean that unions that use that weapon in a kind of not very thoughtful or reckless way won't get clobbered in the process. And frankly, that's a lesson learned by newspaper workers and learned by the UAW itself on occasion. But in this case, it worked.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because someone, can't even remember who said this just the other day, but he said, one thing great about America is that unions have the right to strike, but never to win. So, I was going to say that this is something that not just affects General Motors workers, but this, the whole economy of southeastern Michigan, of our country. It speaks to the, you know, deindustrialization, this process that's been going on for almost 50 years here with our state particularly. And I want to keep that in a focus. But, you know, we're talking, when we're talking about the employees, relatively small number of people in the state of Michigan. And most people do not belong to unions. And they have a variety of different opinions of them. Some of them are sort of benign, like, oh, well, they were good for my father or my grandfather, or and some of them negative. And I thought maybe we could spend a little time, as we weave also through the UAW-GM settlement, some of these arguments, because I was struck. I don't know if you got a chance to see the New York Times, because I know you're visiting out on the West Coast. Did you happen to see the paper today?
Yeah, I read it online or in person every day.
Okay.
So, yes, I have seen it.
Well, you might have missed the ad then. There's this anti-union group, and it says the new union label, and then a big
union fact.
Well, I didn't want to give you, okay, you're fairer than I am, Frank Johnson.
Mr. Rich Berman, the man who brought us Thank You for Smoking.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah, that was his campaign.
Okay.
He made his chops working for Big Tobacco.
Okay. It says the new union label, then it has a big closed sign over a locked plant gate, and it says the new union label brought to you by the union, quote, leaders who helped bankrupt steel, auto, and airline companies. And the idea is, particularly when you see these reports, that the Detroit 3 have to pay so much, this is the fault of the unions. If they hadn't have been so assertive, if they hadn't have been so greedy, if they hadn't have been so militant, that the auto companies never would have been in this situation, nor would steel or the airline companies. How do you answer that?
Well, there are a lot of ways to answer that. Let me try to be sort of as clear and clean and simple about some of them as I can be. As I think you know, Peter, I'm writing a book. The working title is Unions 2020, and it's on this very subject of what kind of unions do we need in the economy we have now, and what's the relationship between those needs and the existing unions. And these are not simple questions, but two or three points quickly. It is true that the labor costs of union employees in some cases, and most notably in manufacturing, have gotten sufficiently out of alignment with the competitive reality of those private sector employers that the history in steel and auto and so on and for 20 years now has been a history of ever drifting lower wages and benefits, and more importantly, reduced membership. Because as the economy globalized and as companies began to have more options to escape unions, that creates enormous downward pressure on wages and benefits. Let's segue from that to the other side of the coin. The thing that most often gets lost in all of this conversation is, what's the purpose of an economy? And, you know, not to sound too silly about it, but what's the purpose of life? And I ask that question in this context. For every high labor cost that was difficult maybe for a company to deal with in an increasingly competitive environment, there's a decent life. There's a middle-class standard of living. There's kids sent to college. There's homes bought. There's vacations taken. Is there something wrong with that? I mean, these people who so glibly say all unions are all bad all the time, by what means do they suggest that we will sustain a decent quality of life for millions and millions of people? Well, the answer to that is they don't have an answer to that.
Well, they do sometimes. It's called the free market, that our labor...
Oh, yes, that is their answer, but the free market doesn't deliver that in and of itself. It didn't deliver when industrialization, when we were going through the de-agricultural period evolving into the industrial period that we're now de-industrializing as a nation, not as a planet, but as a nation. You know, that was a wrenching change in our economy, and unions are correct to claim credit for seeing to it that that change worked out in a way that net benefited the overall economy. You can't have a consumer-driven economy if you don't have a workforce with disposable income with which to buy consumer goods. Seems like a no-brainer, but a lot of people miss that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. A feminist once said, men, you can't live with them and you can't shoot them. you can't live with them, you can't live without them. I mean, so it sort of seems like the latter. I mean, unions, you can't. I mean, I certainly owe so much to my union, the standard of living that I have, the benefits that I have, the retirement funds. I mean, I'm, you know, I owe these people beyond, you know, what I can actually say here. And yet I see other people in our industry that, you know, that are, don't have any of those benefits that aren't unionized. But, that's the employer's always saying your labor costs are going to make, the enterprise unprofitable. It's going to sink our activity. How can you live, with unions and not have, labor costs, do damage to the overall enterprise?
Well, one answer to that, of course, is that the answer to that is not less unionization, it's more unionization. It's the globalization of organized labor so that workers in China and workers in Brazil and workers in South Korea and workers in Alabama are all pursuing, to the degree possible, a coordinated strategy that diminishes these great disparities in labor costs that are irresistible to capital. You know, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to say that an employer who's looking at a gigantic disparity in labor costs in the capitalist system is obligated to their shareholders to say, you know, factor in transportation and other things, but we can get you a better return on your investment if we make that product in Brazil, or if we make it in Mexico, or if we make it in China. And so part of what's happened here, part of what's out of phase, if you will, is that, and it's ironic, no union had a more internationalist outlook for virtually its entire existence than the UAW. But it still couldn't translate that into a global strategy, even within the employees of the common employers, General Motors, Ford, Daimler, Chrysler, et cetera, that the UAW had. Well, that is one thing that's going to have to change if this playing field is going to get leveled again. And there's nothing inevitable about that, by the way. It's another instance in which the UAW and other unions are playing catch-up. Now, the steel workers are in serious merger talks with some unions in Great Britain. The UAW has greatly expanded its international contacts and conferences and coordination in recent years. And so steps are being taken in the right direction, but working people, union members or not, are start out in a deep hole. Well, same as it ever was, I guess.
Well, I've said that one of our options is either to deal with these kind of things directly, or we should just all thatch our roofs and admit that we're going to be peasants. So I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I want to thank you so much for being with me. Frank Joyce, who is a labor communication consultant and also the former director of public relations for the United Auto Worker. Frank, thanks for being with me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you.
This is WRIM.com.
Grandma's old radio. Oh, wouldn't it be grand to gather round and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.
A date which will live in infamy.
Good evening, adults. We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a very special presentation.
Boring. Go back to that infamy guy.
101 FM, WRIF Detroit. Hey, it's Alan Beck, Slayer, welcoming you to Monday and October the 1st. It is officially, as far as I'm concerned, Halloween season, which is, gets me all excited. Also, it's definitely football is in gear now, and the Lions, their record extends to 3-1 after their game yesterday against the Bears as they beat them out 37-27. Playing next week against the Redskins in Washington. Catch the game at 1 p.m. 101 WRIF, lots of riff, rock, and roll coming your way this hour, including some AC/DC, latest from the KID. Got some Alter Bridge, Atreyu, and more. If you need something, feel free to hit me up at 313-298-WRIF. Also via email.